Good afternoon. It's a few minutes after 1 p.m. on Tuesday, April 26, 2005. We're going to open up the Joint Ways and Means Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development. I'm Representative Greg Smith. Sitting to the right of me is Robin Lamont, our subcommittee LFO analyst and our subcommittee scheduler. We also have Kat Bell, our subcommittee assistant. We have a full agenda today, and I want to assure folks who have traveled from a long distance that we will control the agenda and we'll make sure that everyone has an opportunity to testify before the committee. The members will be coming right as we are getting towards the end of session. Members are testifying in other committees and they'll be joining us shortly. With that said, Senator Westland has an excused absence for other business. He's cleared that with me before. Why don't we kick this off? We're starting the Phase 2 presentation on of the Senate Bill 5508, Economic and Community Development Department. Starting off is Marty Brantley, and it looks like you have some commissioners with you.
I do, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for having us here today. Again, we do have a busy agenda, and again, we're trying to respond to many of the questions that came up in Phase 1 and to answer those, too. If I could, Mr. Chairman, just refer to a couple of handouts that you, as well as some of the other members, have. The responses to questions and information have been provided, and they are behind the Phase 2 tab in your booklet here. And then there is a handout also that has been handed out, and these are talking points for today. And so there are two things. Number one, in your book, and number two, your handouts for today and just talking points on the different subject matters that we will go through as we gleaned out of Phase 1. So with that, I'd like to say thank you very much and good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Marty Brantley, Director of Economic and Community Development, and I appreciate the opportunity to present to you this week. At the end of the biennium, the legislature and the governor agreed that creating jobs was the single most important task that we were trying to achieve in 2003-2005. And this department was directed to make it our number one priority, and that is what we have tried to do. Oregon is now number three in terms of job creation and job growth. And our unemployment rate is falling, not as fast as we want it to fall, but it is falling. It's going in the right direction, even as people continue to move in here and add to the workforce, too. So in terms of job creation, the department is working, and it's working well. It's not perfect, but it is, in fact, working, and that's one of the messages that we hope to impart to you today with all of our different partners. Throughout Phase 1, you also had questions about the department's decision-making process on programs and on funds and the utilization of that. That process begins and ends with our economic development partners at the county and community level. Together, we are working on 78 different major projects across the state. That's twice the number of projects that we collaborated with on last year and three times more than we had 2 years ago. And in terms of our regional-rural partnership, the departmentship, again, is working. It needs help in some areas, but we have come a long, long way in the last couple of years. As communities reach out to us for guidance and assistance, the state reaches back to anticipate and meet their needs. Every decision OECD makes begins with a community request, a local proposal, and a local connection. As a project develops, we continually seek input from our local leaders. They are our eyes and they are our ears, and we don't make a move without them. This week, we have invited some of our guests to these hearings, both today, tomorrow, and Thursday, local leaders who want to share their views with you in various aspects of community development. And you should know that the commission that oversees our department is comprised of really effective community leaders also. So I'd like to introduce a couple of them to you. Two members on my left here are the Oregon Economic and Community Development Commission, are Wally Von Valkenburg, our chairman, who is a partner at Stowell Reeves, where he chairs the firm's technology and intellectual property practice group. And we also have Commissioner Tony Hyde from Columbia County with an extensive economic development background over 20 years in the forestry industry as well as other industries we find, too. So I can't speak highly enough for the commission and my relationship, in my opinion, with the commission. It has been wonderful. They have been there and been eager to participate in any of the decisions that we ask them to be involved in. So at this point, I'd like to invite Wally and Tony to provide you with an overview of the department's work in this biennium.
Thank you, Marty. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for inviting us here today. For the record, my name is Wally Van Valkenburg. I chair the Oregon Economic and Community Development Commission. As you all know, the commission is a bipartisan board appointed by the governor to oversee OECDD. Our commission includes representation from around the state. I think we all feel privileged to be able to have a role in trying to improve economic opportunities for all of Oregon. Excuse me. I'm going to make some very brief introductory remarks, but before I do, I would just like to say on behalf of the commission that we're very proud of the work the department has done since your last session. With limited resources, but with a lot of hard work by some very talented people, the department in the last 2 years has focused in a very disciplined way on job creation in Oregon and on promoting an agenda set by both the legislature and the governor to help move us out of the recession. Now, this week you'll be hearing from some of these hardworking people. The senior management of the department will bring you the results of several of the department's programs to help you understand what we think is working for economic development in Oregon and what programs or tactics may need your attention. And while our management team is coming to you with the goal of informing your committee, they, as well as my commission, are eager to hear your suggestions and understand what you hear from your constituents around the state about what we are doing right and about where we can improve. As far as results go, there's good news to report. As Marty mentioned, Oregon in 2004 actually ranked ninth best in the nation in employment growth, adding 34,000 jobs. Our challenge is that while we were adding all these new jobs, we were also adding a lot of new Oregonians. As we all know, this is a great place to live, and it's so great that a lot of people come here without jobs, and that makes the task of bringing down our unemployment rate all the more challenging. So while I think we've done a good job with job creation, we still have work to do to bring the unemployment rate down further. What credit should the department get for creating these new jobs? I'd be the first to say that it's the private sector that's responsible for job creation, not the government. What the department has tried to do is to identify areas where we as a state can set the table for the private sector to create jobs. We've also tried to make sure we get the message out both to companies looking to move here and to companies already here that Oregon is not only a great place to live but also a great place to do business. In those areas, I think you'll find the department has played a significant role in helping Oregon businesses create jobs. Some of those efforts involve direct recruitment of businesses by the department. Others involve working with businesses already here to help attract companies that may be part of existing industry clusters, such as the department's work with the food processing industry and with the department's innovative economy initiative, about which you'll hear more later this afternoon. Still others involve our communication strategy, how we portray ourselves to business people outside Oregon. My business card, which I got when I became a member of the commission, says, "Oregon business, come for a week, stay forever." It's an effort to change the traditional come visit but don't stay that Oregon used to be known for. I'd also like to just focus briefly on how the department's economic development efforts interplay with its responsibilities in the area of community development. In addition to the areas I just mentioned, the department helps communities build infrastructure, certifies industrial lands, and assists local community in areas like planning and workforce development. When I first joined the commission, which was just after your last session, I was told that the 2003 legislature had directed the department to focus first and foremost on job creation. At the time, I thought to myself, well, what else would an economic development agency focus on? But I learned that there is sometimes perceived to be a tension between economic development or job creation and community development. I'd like to suggest that that's a false dichotomy, and from what I've seen during my time on the commission, the two have to go hand in hand. Economic development cannot occur without strong communities, and the communities around the state need to be integral parts of the department's efforts. The job creation figures that we report belong to Oregon's communities as much as they do to the state. The fact that we have such good progress to report, in my view, is as much of a reflection on the solid positive relationships we have cultivated with local leaders as with anything else. But there remains a tendency at times for this false dichotomy to rear its head. When Oregon's economy is strong, there's sometimes a tendency to downplay the importance of job creation and to focus on community development. When the economy is weak, the reverse is true. That's where we were 2 years ago, with the economy weak, and that's why today nearly every program we will describe to you is reported in terms of creating jobs or growing businesses. That's not because the department isn't working closely with communities. It's because the measure of the department's success in a recessionary period is necessarily on jobs. It's what you asked us to do in 2003. In closing, I would say that our commission recognized the hard work that lies ahead. I would also say we have made remarkable progress since you last reviewed the department in 2003, not the least of which is a heightened level of cooperation between the department and business and community leaders around the state. We're all trying to help Oregon get the message out that this is a great place to do business. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I'll now turn this over to one of the community leaders I was referring to, my fellow commissioner, Tony Hyde.
Really quick, is there any questions of the committee? It's very good having you, Chair Van Valkenburg. Let me ask one or two questions, if I may. Who is the customer of the department?
Well, that's a good question. I think we have a number of different customers. First and foremost, our customer is the people of the state of Oregon who need the assistance the department provides to help grow the economy and create good family wage jobs. The department tries to do that by working with a variety of different customers. The department works with companies that are looking to locate here. It works with companies that are already here. It also works with the leaders of various community organizations, whether they be counties, local development commissions, in some cases public-private partnerships that are designed to help grow the economy. So those are all customers of the department, in my view, Mr. Chairman.
Terrific. Thank you. Thank you. One thing I hope each of you will address as we go through the coming days, particularly the directors, is talk with us about how we've gotten to where we are today in terms of an overall economic development strategy. As I look around the room, some of us have been doing economic development for a very long time, and some of us remember in the mid-90s one approach, and then we moved to another, and as times progress, so are we, to another approach. And so those folks who are going to be coming forward today, please help this committee understand how economic development evolves and how the department has evolved. So, thank you.
One observation on that, Mr. Chairman, and I'm relatively new at this compared to you and many others, but what I've seen and what I understand from some of the history is that it's like a business that you kind of have to adapt to your market, and a strategy that makes sense in 1999 maybe didn't make sense in 2003, and a strategy that made sense 2 years ago maybe needs some tweaking today. So I think what I understand the department to be here to do is to talk to you about what we think has worked and to get input from you all on maybe some things we ought to think about differently.
Terrific. Commissioner Hyde, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I am Tony Hyde, member of the Economic and Community Development Commission, also chair of the Board of Commissioners in Columbia County and past president of the Association of Oregon Counties. Whether towards jobs or communities, the Assembly today will determine which way the pendulum swings in 2005-2007. The department will outline the path we took in 2002-2005, so you can understand the rationale for and results of earlier actions. Let me give you a preview. The department, with commission guidance, has embarked on innovative development programs that are helping us achieve the number one goal of more jobs in Oregon, more jobs to Oregonians. Two programs took precedence in 2003-2005 because they are critical to job creation now and for Oregon's long-term economic growth: industrial lands and innovation. The urgent need for economic growth and jobs in 2003 caused the legislature to issue very clear marching orders. OECD was asked to put available resources into bringing industrial lands closer to development. This was determined to be the number one strategy for the state to support business recruitment and expansion and create jobs. We complied, and today we have good news to share about our progress on industrial lands. Secondly, we were directed to build innovation into our economic development efforts. With Oregon behind the curve in 2003, the legislature recognized pressure to help Oregon businesses become, stay competitive in an increasing global marketplace. The department started the groundwork, and today we have a compelling story to tell about the innovative business, not just high-tech, but homegrown industries, and how they're doing well to rise above the pack in Oregon. These are the only new initiatives we're working on: the industrial lands and innovation. And for 2005-07, we have one new initiative to bring you: an innovative policy package that advances what we learned and tested in the last biennium. For industrial lands, we also seek new additional funding because Oregon is now reaping the benefits of the last 2 years' efforts. The program promises to bring much more in the years ahead if we can heighten our investment today. Other than these two programs, the department seeks only to continue the projects that we've been given in the last legislative session. With an eye to the future and recognizing the cyclic swing of emphasis from economic development to community development, we look forward to discussing and tailoring our programs by your direction in a vigorous package that assures Oregon's prosperity. With that, I would like to say that I understand that there's been a lot of discussion around the idea of an interim committee, and both for the interim between now and the next session and ongoing. I personally endorse that idea. I think it's a wonderful idea. I think it's long overdue. You know, years ago, longer than I'd like to think, I was a commercial fisherman in Alaska. And we went from one season to another. And between seasons, we had to shift gear. We had to change the nets. We had to completely re-gear and refit the boat in order to be able to catch that next species of fish. Mm-hmm. And I see that's what's been happening to the department every single legislative session. But I think the time to refit the boat is in the interim, not in the 6 months that we have to take a look at the budgetary issues, because it takes a long time. And if you look at that out of context, it looks like the department's doing nothing, when in fact the department spends an awful lot of time refitting and re-gearing and retraining. So I really endorse the idea of an interim committee. I think it's a great idea. I think that we have some issues that continue to plague the department and all the stakeholders around, for instance, contracting and the time it takes and the holdup in the AG's office. And really, the contracting issue is more of an indicator than the problem. I think we really need to take the time to look at the problem. When you make structural changes, they need to be done thoughtfully, with little or no unintended consequences, and with all the stakeholders at the table. So I really endorse that concept. Thank you, Mr. Chair. With that, I'd like to introduce Mike Burton and Sarah Garrison, who give you more about the industrial initiative.
Any question of the commissioners or the director? Thank you, Commissioner Hyde. Thank you. We truly are in this all together, the counties, the cities, the ports, our special districts in the state of Oregon, along with the private sector, which includes our bankers and our realtors and our small business owners, really are in this together. And I think you're right. Hopefully over the coming days and into the future, we'll be able to find a strategy that's going to work for Oregon. Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chair, before this panel leaves, I'd like to acknowledge how much help Commissioner Hyde has been to me in understanding issues around economic development. We work very collaboratively together, and I have been the beneficiary of his expertise, so I just wanted to acknowledge that.
Welcome. You could just each of you introduce yourselves for the record.
Chair Smith, members of the committee, my name is Mike Burton. I'm the Community Development Division Manager of the Department. I'm with Sarah Garrison, the Capital Projects Division Manager of the Department, Dick Sheehy from IDC, the famous Ms. Cora Parker from Tax Budget and Management, and joining us in this panel will be John Hitt, City Manager from Lebanon.
Do you want to come on up? We can make that work. We just have to squeeze together. There we go.
You won't ask any questions.
We have a promise. As you heard, the department got clear direction from the last legislature and from the governor's office to focus on, among other things, industrial lands. That's because there's a problem facing Oregon. The way the problem shakes out is in some places we just don't have any land. We're victims of our success for the most part. In other places, the land we have for sale is not ready for the marketplace. It doesn't address the needs of purchasers of that land. And as a result, over the last several years, Oregon has seen projects go other places because we couldn't respond to the question fast enough. So the department responding to House Bill 2011, an action party of this committee we're members of, and responding to Executive Order 0302, created a certified site process. First, in response to the House bill, the department convened a group of experts in terms of real estate, industrial development and recruitment, like Mr. Sheehy, and using our own expertise, created a list of the characteristics that are essential for the marketplace. You got to remember this is a market-driven program. Then from that, the same committee took a look at sites available across the state, some 160-some sites, and using the criteria available, weeded it down to 25 sites that would make a difference to Oregon. Those sites are being called today the opportunity sites. In addition, the executive order created this certification process, which takes those characteristics identified by the committee and the department, and the department walks through a process that verifies that these sites are ready to go. They're ready for what the market requires. The process is working. We have 24 sites certified today. Of those, 9 are the opportunity sites. We've had 37 sites visited. By the end of the biennium, we'll be close to 50 sites. We've got a box of binders on their way back to the third-party verifier now. And we're on our way to 50 sites. We'll be there close to that by the end of the biennium. Additionally, the process is working.
Senator Johnson.
Mr. Burton, excuse me for interrupting you. I just wanted to ask a question about the process to get to those certified sites. And really what I'm trying to feel out is the strength of the partners on the ground that you used in the locations where the sites were certified, how well that worked, whether or not, in your opinion, there was adequate expertise on the ground to work with the department to create those sites, or were there instances, for example, and I'm just conjuring this, that there were some that may not have had the same strength, either in their own internal staff or with available consultants. And how was that dealt with, or were they all up to the task of doing the work required by the local partners?
Chair Smith, Senator Johnson, we're going to get into the process in a little bit more detail a little bit later.
Oh, then I'll happily hold my question.
I would attempt to answer the question just quickly in two regards. One is there is a gap between what the marketplace demands and what the sellers are offering, what purchasers are looking for, and what sellers are putting on the table. That's been a fundamental problem statewide. I mean, there is a capacity issue in that, in general, people with property for sale don't understand what the firms represented by Mr. Sheehy, the firm looking at a site, about to close a deal on a site in Lebanon, require. So there is a fundamental gap there. And I think that's, if nothing else, we've had an extensive conversation over the last 2 years about what that is, and we're making a lot of progress in terms of having people understand what the marketplace demands.
Mr. Chair, with your indulgence, just so you can anticipate this question, Mr. Burton, I asked my question obviously incorrectly because you answered a very interesting question. It just wasn't mine. The question that I was asking was, in terms of working through some of the limitations on the sites, they may have had wetland issues, they may have been brownfields, they may have been had some transportation impediment. I'm making the assumption that in most cases you worked with the owners of the property or with some public entity working with the owners of the property if the public entity didn't own it. And there was an expectation that those on-the-ground folks performed in a way to assist the agency in bringing the property to a point where it could be certified. And what I'm trying to tease out from your presentation is the strength of the local effort to make those properties available. Was there local expertise that had the right consultants in place to deal with the DSL issues? Was there the right marketing after the site was brought to certification? I'm trying to feel out for the sites that the effort and expense was expended to bring to certification. How reliable was the partnership on the other end? You had the agency on one end, and you had somebody or something or some unit of government on the other end, and I'm trying to figure out how it worked on the ground end.
Chair Smith or Senator Johnson, I do believe I understand the question.
And you can come back to me with an answer. It's a complicated question, so I don't want you to have to respond on the fly. But at some point, that's a curiosity that I have. And what I'm driving to is if the certification process worked in a way that there were reliable partners on the other end and the work could be accomplished smoothly with some input away from the opposite end of the spectrum from OECD, that's great. If it didn't, and responsibility fell back on the state to try to bring those sites up to a certain point, I want to just find out how well did that work? With no value judgment implied, I'm just interested in gathering the facts to see how well it worked.
Chair Smith, Senator Johnson, I understand the question. We can get there. I do want to restate my original comment. We started off with a fundamental gap that there was basically nobody out there, with a few exceptions, people doing business every day on a national or international real estate market, understand the marketplace. But in general, in Oregon, there was a lower level of expectation among sellers than the marketplace demands. And
let me take a shot at this, Mike. As you folks were going through and certifying property, were you making sure that your local partners had a plan for operating the sites into the future? Were you making sure that they had a cash flow budget? Making sure that there was a plan to somehow one day get out of the project?
Chair Smith, let us move forward, and we'll come back and make sure we cover that at the end. I'll make a note because I'm about to wrap up my intro, and I'll make a note and make sure that we've covered the base by the time we're done.
Okay.
The state role derived from three things. The state does in this process. One, we certify the sites. There's a stamp of approval from the directors of the economic revitalization team agencies and the governor's office.
How long does that take?
It depends on the readiness of the site. The actual certification process, once the site's done, is a matter of a few days or weeks at most. But bringing some sites from a piece of bare ground to certification has taken us, in some cases, 18 months.
What would be the mean? Not the average, but the mean.
It depends on the readiness of the site. But if it's a normal site on the edge of town, zone industrial, you're talking a few months to get the certification.
Thank you.
So the state is certifying the sites. Capital Projects works with folks to plan for and provide the infrastructure needed to bring the site to readiness. And ultimately, the department markets the sites. with local partners, but our business development division is actively working with businesses seeking sites on an ongoing basis. The state has a role in this, and it has to be the state, in my opinion, because the state has the ability to inform the process. We're dealing with these customers on an ongoing daily basis. We can bring regional partners and regulatory agencies to the state, and I think this in part gets to Senator Johnson's question about who's out there on the other side of the question. And through our revolving loan funds, which I think is a critical piece, we're for the most part making loans for those improvements to bring these sites to the marketplace. We can make a difference. You can make a difference in the industrial land supply in Oregon.
Can I just share one point for the committee? It's important for us to understand that we don't have a policy issue here because this was approved by the legislature last session, and the department is carrying out the implementation of industrial sites. So I just want to clarify something.
And I will hand it to Sarah Garrison to explain how we're doing it.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Sarah Garrison. I'm the Capital Projects Division Manager for the Department. As Mike stated, there are three phases that the Department's involved in the Industrial Lands Initiative. I want to walk you through each phase a little bit, talk about the process, and then the outcome of the overall effort. And I wanted to first start with the site certification, because I don't think what we've told you thus far is what it means to be a certified site. By definition, a certified site is ready for construction within 6 months or less of being chosen for development by a business. The certified site has comprehensive information available on the capacity and availability of water, sewer, power, telecommunications, on environmental, cultural, and land issues, transportation accessibility, and much, much more. And it's really a process that identifies market needs. And certification is all about documenting those market needs. So in certifying the industrial lands, we work with property owners, realtors, municipalities, and other state agencies. The state agencies really provide the clearance for the environmental conditions, for the wetlands, the endangered species, and the cultural resources. They're the experts on those. The local governments really provide the assurances that the industry certification profiles that are developed by each site and each locality for that site, they conform to local zoning regulations and that there is local support for the development. Certification has benefits both to businesses and to property owners. On the business side, it's a collection and validation of information needed by companies as they make business development siting decisions. It also provides certainty to site selectors that the site will meet their development objectives. So therefore, it saves time, it minimizes risk factors, and it lowers the cost of doing business, making Oregon competitive. It also has benefits for site owners. It educates the landowners on what is needed by a business that's considering acquisition and use of a site. It also provides a method for assessing the readiness of the site for a potential development project. It also identifies potential development barriers in the process. It also promotes fairness. Each site receives a consistent level of analysis in determining its readiness, such as wetlands, environmental constraints, cultural resources, land use regulations, a consistent level of analysis. So therefore, it increases a site's competitiveness in a marketplace that really has increasingly shorter project development timelines. So for us, industrial site certification is a vital tool that communicates to the business community that Oregon is open for business. It also demonstrates a strong commitment by state and local governments and the property owners that we will expedite the business siting process. The second phase that we're involved in is infrastructure planning and development. We are responsible for working with local governments, local property owners, to determine the potential market feasibility of these candidate sites, and then also to identify the infrastructure needs. The key really was to provide the upfront planning necessary to identify and overcome barriers to development on these sites. And as the industrial sites are evaluated, most sites did require some removal of obstacles and some level of funding to move them to certification. The funding from the department can be used for a variety of purposes. It can be used for assessing the marketability of the site. It can be used for determining the environmental conditions of the site, can be used for removing environmental or other regulatory constraints of the site. We can plan for the needed infrastructure, and we can also provide financial resources, loans and grants, for the infrastructure development itself.
But how would you break out in the request for $61 million?
Mm-hmm.
How would you break out how much is going to be used for hard assets, acquiring hard assets, and how much is going to be used for admin, consulting, review?
I think the basic consulting, and I'll let Mike answer it if I get it wrong, but if the basic consulting that we're having right now is with the third-party verifier. That's the majority of it. Now, there is an effort by Division of State Lands, by DEQ, as they're involved in the industrial process, but as I understand it, their staff is doing that in their own budgets. We are providing some funding for consultants if they need to go in and do the wetlands delineation or determinations or the environmental assessments. I would still think that that would be a smaller part than if a community then wanted to come in and actually do the construction. But it's important to note that in a certified site, you don't necessarily have to have every pipe in the ground, the curb cuts, the whole industrial site platted. What needs to happen is that they have a plan for bringing the infrastructure when a business is ready. So we're not in the business of if you build it, they will come. So for a certified site, they do need a financial plan. They do need to know what infrastructure would be needed. And each community develops, and each site has an industry profile, one of eight. And I don't remember all the eight, but they're basically heavy industrial, high tech, warehouse distribution, call center, light industrial, those types of things. So a community really looks to their own strategic plan and what they need in their community and what assets they have in the community as they choose the industrial profile for that site. And then the infrastructure is sized for that type of industry.
Let me share with everyone out in the audience and remind the committee where we are is in phase two. During phase one is where we kind of did a high overview, and we walked through and got an overview of what's going on in each of the departments and agencies of the state. In phase two is where we're starting to ask the in-depth questions. Why are we doing this? How are we doing that? Starting to ask numbers. Then in phase three is when we will really get down into the arm wrestling, if you will, and with each agency and figure out what's the best use of the limited dollars we have. So as you hear questions that may sound very pointed, it's the nature of this process at this point in phase two. We're just trying to get to the answers. So,
Chair Smith, if I could quickly. In the materials you were given, the follow-up on phase one given yesterday or the day before, there is a sheet that details the cost for this technical assistance consulting work done on the first 24 sites. It amounts to a few thousands of dollars per site on the average. So in the question related to the $60 million, it's almost all going to be capital investments in the form of loans that will be paid back when the land sells or leases.
Okay. And then just so the committee's clear on this, as those loans are paid back, that will go into a fund that's going to evolve and be able for additional development around the state.
Exactly.
Thank you.
And in the department, there are two main funding programs that we use to provide help with the planning and the infrastructure development or the construction for these industrial sites. Those are basically the Special Public Works Fund and the Brownfield Redevelopment Fund, which are primarily operated as revolving loan funds. The third phase of our industrial lands initiative to close the loop is really marketing. It's the business recruitment and expansion activities. So once a site is certified, the department also takes the lead role in marketing these sites to potential industrial clients. And it's done through many avenues. I'll give you a few examples. One is the OregonProspector.com. It's the state's official public-private website for site consultants and businesses interested in relocating or expanding a business in Oregon. The private sector partners who were involved in the development and maintenance of this site include Pacific Power, Avista Utilities, Northwest Natural, Portland General Electric, Sprint, and the Oregon Economic Development Association. The website provides a comprehensive database of available sites, the buildings by city, by county, by building size, by type, etc. The site is currently experiencing an average of 500 hits a day. The second way that we market these sites is through Brand Oregon. Working with the Oregon Economic Development Association, we created a one-page business recruitment ad featuring Governor Kulongoski.
What's the plan for marketing now in the future? I see that in the budget, Brand Oregon has been zeroed out.
I'm not as familiar with Brand Oregon. Maybe Cora can help us.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Brand Oregon has not been zeroed out the budget. We did not provide any additional funding for Brand Oregon. We assume that the department will continue to contribute via loan, grant, whatever appropriate funding source is available to that program in a way that makes it competitive with any other economic development opportunity that is presented to the department. For example, I'm just going to make up an example. If an agricultural group or some other group presents to the Brand Oregon Board an opportunity to bring in private sector funding that would be leveraged and would be able to bring in a certain return on investment to the state, that will be weighed against any other opportunity that was presented to the department. And if there's a funding source available and the return on investment makes sense, it would be appropriate.
So is policy option package 109, when it says Brand Oregon, not recommended?
That was for additional funds. That was for, and that's something that probably audience members don't even see. That was not a part of the governor's recommended budget. It was a request from the agency during the agency request.
But it says here that the policy package is not approved, it will essentially stop the momentum that has been built up for Brand Oregon marketing.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, that was based on a set of assumptions that were not included in the governor's recommended budget. The direction via the governor's recommended budget was not to zero out funding for the program, but to basically look at it in a different way. The initial package would have said, I think it was $2 million. You'll have to, you'll have, you're looking at it or not.
Well, I just want to be clear on this because this is important. We're trying to raise an additional $150,000 in. The last sentence in here says Brand Oregon simply cannot continue without staff and without seed funding for cooperative marketing campaigns.
And Mr. Chair, I think in the original agency request budget, which was put forward last June and August, that was the concept and the context in which that original package was put together.
Okay.
During the budget development process for the governor's recommended budget, we worked with the agency and with a partner and said, is there a different way to look at this? Basically, instead of singling out a specific amount of money that would have been dedicated only for that purpose, and if that amount wasn't necessary for the return that would for the other opportunities that were brought forward, it would not then be available for other purposes in the department. Instead, the discussion was that we will not identify it as a separate standalone, that as Brand Oregon Board recommendations are brought forward and there are opportunities to leverage with private sector partners, they will compete for funding on the basis of ROI, just like any other opportunity will be brought forward.
What I would just suggest is let's move on, but when we get to Brand Oregon, if someone could help me reconcile this comment with the ability to manage the program without this policy option package.
Okay. The one-page business recruitment ad from Brand Oregon really encouraged readers to email or call the governor or the department about doing business in Oregon and about the state's recently certified industrial sites. Another avenue we market is through the national business recruitment. All of our business development officers who are located around the state and are the key points of contact for many firms looking to relocate here or expand their operations in Oregon. The department's also focused on building personal relationships with top-tier site consultants around the nation by providing ongoing awareness of the increased activity in Oregon's economy. This has resulted in increased activity on business recruitment leads statewide. All of our BDOs, or business development officers, are knowledgeable of the certified site process and the valuable information available to site owners and site selectors. Let me talk a little bit about the outcome and results. We have created the certification program, and the department is currently working with over 100 property owners to gather and validate the information necessary for site certification. By the end of the biennium, as Mike says, we should have close to 50 sites certified. The program is working. Sales are pending on many sites in many locations around the state, including Lebanon, the Dalles, and Fossil. Two major projects have already broken ground in Klamath Falls and Coos Bay. While some Oregon communities have been experiencing high interest in their newly certified industrial sites, not all have been receptive to certifying their industrial lands. We are continuing to collect community feedback and continue to explain and demonstrate the values of certification. So what's next? We believe the effort is at a turning point. Thus far, we've been able to certify those sites that we consider low-hanging fruit. That means the sites have required few or minor investments to become certified. We expect the next phase of the program will involve greater investment in time and resources, and some of that addresses Senator Johnson's question about capacity. The easier sites have been in some of the larger metropolitan areas and have had more capacity. As we go on, we're going to need to spend more time and effort both on the state level and the local level to help some of these communities that have major barriers to their certification. So to change the inventory in a meaningful way, the state must be prepared to invest in the reuse of facilities such as brownfields and in bringing the provision of infrastructure to bring new sites online. Brownfield redevelopment and infrastructure investment are expensive, ranging in the tens of millions of dollars, especially for large sites. So the department does not currently have the financial resources to make investments on this magnitude. So we do ask you to approve the governor's recommended budget and the $61 million policy package to really enable a significant change in the industrial land inventory in Oregon and to facilitate the siting of businesses and creating jobs. We have many partners in this effort, and I would like to turn the testimony over to some of our partners to get their perspective.
Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dick Sheehy. I work with IDC, which is part of the CH2M Hill family companies. CH, we have about 130 offices around the world, about 15,000 people. IDC is the industrial business group, which we work with technology companies in design and build technically advanced facilities around the world. Such a lot of our clients are Intel, HP, IBM, TI, Applied Materials. We also do lab construction and work presently working at OHSU and at Oregon State. My particular job is to evaluate sites and find sites for clients. So I'm kind of one of the customers that you referred to, and my comments today will be about the, from a customer's point of view, really, and the importance of available industrial lands. I was born in the city of Baker before it was called Baker City, so that tells you a little bit how old I am. Attended Oregon State, and I've lived in Beaverton for the last 20 years. So, you know, economic development is really about investment in jobs, and the product that you need to have available is land or the ability to provide an avenue to create jobs. One message is that this is a very competitive industry. I deal with states all over the country and even some at a country level in some of the international locations. Singapore is probably one of the best examples of economic development strategy. They're a small island. When they run out of land, they build land. They literally create more land. They're in the process of creating 700-acre biofarm park right now by dredging, filling, and creating new land. So that's kind of the extreme. I wouldn't suggest Oregon taxpayer money doing that. The industrial lands kind of goes into what our land use process was a number of years ago when it was developed, approximately 30 years ago, and what it is today. We used to identify land as, let's put them there where nobody wants to live. The worst land we had. That today is different because companies today are looking for properties that really are more coexistent with housing and the other things that go along with a good quality of life. Today's development process is a very complicated process. There's a lot of unknowns and a lot of uncertainty, and I think the industrial land certification process is addressing some of that uncertainty and cost. Delay for a project that we're working on is one of the easiest way to kill a project, and having uncertainty, having unknown costs can create delays that really can put a project in jeopardy. I think one of the important things we look for when we go to a new location or a new state, whether it be Oregon or New York or Florida, would be political support. Things like the Enterprise Zone, the Strategic Investment Program, shows us that a state is supportive of industry, supportive of job growth, and will create the avenues that when issues come up from the public input side, they can be addressed appropriately. Infrastructure is one thing that plagues every state in this process and development, in that there's a lot of long lead items. The public process you have to go through, there can be issues that come up that can't be overcome unless you have some political support, so that's important. I think having state guidance and the investment necessary to have property ready is very important. I guarantee you every state in this, well, probably not every state, but pretty close, says they're open for business. So you have to do more, and you have to have product on the shelf when somebody's looking to make an investment. You can back up your words. So I'd be happy to answer any questions that you would have, but thank you for the opportunity.
Any questions of the committee? Representative or Senator Berger.
Yes, I do. I'd like to ask Dick Sheehy, since you travel around and can compare, and you're a good Oregonian, and I've known you a long time, I want you to be honest with me. Tell me how do we compare? How do we shake out when you go to, whether it's Florida or New York? Are we doing, and I'm not talking about the department, I'm talking about the political support that you need when you go in, because the department is running as the legislature tells them to do and as they advise mm-hmm. them. And if we need to do a better job, we are not going to do better. Ignorance is not bliss. We need to know what we need to do to get better. So would you share with me a little bit of that?
Senator Berger, yes, I'd be happy to answer your question. I think the first part of your question was how do we really compare in the support and political support. It's not a zero-sum game, and it's always changing. That is the issue. With change of administration, some states literally turn around overnight to not be as successful or not be as supportive as they have in the past. I would rate Oregon, in my experience in dealing with states around the country, as probably middle of the pack. Middle of the pack. Part of our problem, I think, as Oregonians, is we all believe this is the best place in the world to live. We don't want to live anywhere else, so people are coming anyway. Therefore, we don't have to support it. And that's not the world competition today. There's a lot of nice places out there to live, trust me. I've been there. And even places you would not even think about going are nice places to live. If there weren't, people wouldn't live there. So the support has to be there, and I'd say we're middle of the pack. We've been better in the past. We've been worse in the past. But it is leadership, but I believe starts at the governor's level. So having Governor Kulongoski say that this is the most important thing, that we need to create jobs, is one of the best support things that we have going for us right now. But you have to back it up. You can walk into the store, and if there's, you know, the sign says you're open for business, and everybody greets you with a handshake, and you walk in the door, and there's nothing on the shelves, what are you going to buy?
Thank you.
Welcome.
Hi, my name is John Hitt. I'm a city manager of the city of Lebanon. Mr. Chairman, senators, appreciate the opportunity to be with you. Lebanon is a city of about 13,000, about 12 miles southeast of the city of Albany. We have had a 200-plus acre size parcel of industrially zoned land within the city limits for since 1980. And that land was looked at by a variety of prospective industrial developers, always passed over. And less than a year ago, this site was certified as part of the process you've been hearing about this afternoon. I expect in just a few weeks that we will have a public announcement about a major Fortune 50 U.S. company constructing a regional distribution center there that will bring 600 to 700 family wage jobs to East Lynn County, an area that has for many years now been at or above 10% unemployment.
Senator Johnson.
Just for the edification of the panel and the people that are listening, could you walk us through some of the details of that certification? Who owned the site? How did it bubble up as being one that right. was worthy of this level of investment? Who were the players? This seems like a huge success story, and it might be instructive for us all to hear it.
And let me tell it in the context of what I think the industrial certification process really brings to the table. That was an enormous help to us, and I think is probably enormous help to a lot of other communities. First off, it's a carrot. It's a carrot that allows us to go to the property owners. In this case, we had two long-standing farm families that were property owners, available to go, allows us to go to local agencies, utility providers, and say, give us the information, give us the cooperation that we need to get through the certification process. And the big bonus is this site will be certified. This site will get the kind of recognition and the kind of appeal that will bring it to a new level as far as possibly getting it sold and getting it developed. So big carrot.
May I just nuance this a little bit? These were willing sellers that were looking around for an opportunity to part with the farm?
Yes, the land had been for sale virtually continuously since 1980 by the same owners, correct. The second thing it brings to the table, which was a huge help in this situation, was it looks at it in a very holistic and yet at the same time detailed approach so that we can know what exactly we need to do in a very precise and a very orderly way to bring this land to the level of being ready to be developed, being attractive to potential developer. I had this, and I've been city manager there in Lebanon for 5 years. We had people come and look at this piece of property and then ask me questions. Well, what about environmental issues? Well, what about wetlands issues? Well, what about, have you done any looking? Are there any cultural or historic resources there? I always shrug my shoulders and say, I don't know. Go to the property owners and say, can you help us out here in any way? And they would say either, A, I'm not interested in helping you out, or in this case, and this gets to the third benefit, we don't have the money. We don't have the investment to be able to give to answer some of those questions. We as a small city didn't have the money. So the other thing this process brings to the table is some funds to help us begin to hire the consultants, hire the assistants to be able to answer those questions to know where exactly we are. Also forced us and all the other utility providers to say, okay, what exactly does this site need in the way of roads, in the way of sewers, in the way of water lines, electricity, et cetera, to really make this site ready to go and then begin to plan the financing and ability to pay for that infrastructure.
And, Mr. And so at the point that all of this is unfolding, your local government folks are engaged in the process.
Yes.
Everybody's pretty much on board. You have a goal in mind.
Yes.
of what you want to achieve when it's there. And a commitment, I presume, to do the heavy lifting of the marketing and showing the site to folks after all of this upfront effort is put in.
Absolutely. I don't think there's any way the announcement we expect to make regarding the regional distribution center, I don't think it's a coincidence. It's not a result of just a good economy. It's, to me, a clear and unequivocal result of this certification process. Because when they began to approach us, they started asking a whole lot of detailed questions, even much more detailed questions than we'd been asked by anybody before. And most of the time, I don't know if those are the binders back there, but they're about that thick, the certification binders. And we could say, well, it's on page 55-2. Or if it wasn't already there, it was something we'd already carefully looked at and could very quickly then from the information and the studies we already had done or had been done for us, get those answers back to them.
And the final piece, Mr. Chair, the families that owned the property,
yes.
Did they incur any financial responsibility in bringing the site to certification?
In this particular case, directly, no. That was borne through the state, not necessarily the OECDD. We also had some help from DSL, and some of it was city-provided funding.
Final question.
Please.
Was the deal with the family consummated before this public attention and influx of public money?
No, after.
Okay, and what I'm trying to figure out, and I don't want to pick on your side, I'm just trying to understand how this all works. A site that has languished, large public investment of time, attention, staff work, financial resources, sellers sell the property and benefit. I'm trying to figure out, undoubtedly, once it was certified, it was sold at a considerable benefit if it had languished on the market prior to that.
Correct.
I'm trying to figure out how that works, where there's this investment of public money and what, at least in the description of what you're telling me, huge private inurement. And I'm just trying to understand how that works.
Well, I tend to look at it from the other side of the coin. Yes, did the owners have a significant gain here? Yes, they did. But, again, the certification process brought a level of cooperation and support, not necessarily direct financial support, but at least support and willingness to work very closely with us and the other agencies involved, which we didn't have before. It was always, you city folks say you want to find a buyer for this, but, I don't really want to cooperate. I'm out here farming. Just kind of leave me alone. So we got past that. We got the cooperation. And the other side of it, I look at it is, regardless of their personal financial gain or family financial gain, we as a community have a huge gain in the sense of jobs, in the sense of new infrastructure, which we badly needed anyway, and of course, a massive increase in our tax base.
Thank you. Mr. Burton.
Chair Smith, Representative Johnson. I hope we're running behind. I hope we've answered the questions. If not, then I will draft a response to your question about the capacity of our partners.
Well, I want to ask a few questions.
I would say, in response to Senator Johnson's last line of questioning, that she has exactly illustrated where we think the program needs to go. We believe that we're creating significant, huge value added for these people, and we expect to get paid back at the time that they realize that value, which would be selling or leasing the properties. For the first round, we've borne the cost. We had to demonstrate to people that they're off base and that when we get here, it'll work. But we expect the value added that is being created in this process to pay us back and create the revolving element that will make this thing work on an ongoing basis.
Thank you. That was very helpful. This has been a question I've had for a long time because, obviously, I think people that are listening to this or have observed the program say, how do I get in the queue? Property that hasn't moved in forever. All of a sudden, this massive influx of public attention and investment, they walk away with a huge payday, and I think it's a legitimate question to say, I got 140 acres someplace I'd like you to take a look at. And just so that we continue to understand what it is we're doing and that there's a public education piece that accompanies it so that everybody's brought along with a similar understanding of why this is a worthwhile public investment.
Well, thank you. Why don't we move on?
Okay. Thank you. I'm going to invite folks up to speak to regional and rural investment at this point.
Is that what you want to do?
Yeah.
Okay. We have a long list of folks who are looking to testify, and so why don't we...
I'm going to invite some of them to the table now.
Are you?
And I'm going to make my comments as brief as I possibly can. I'm just going to frame the discussion, invite some people to talk specifically to the program, and then try to move us through so that we have time to get to the people who've signed up to speak.
Terrific. Perfect.
All right. I'm not going to introduce myself again. I will introduce the people with me. The Honorable Judge Steve Grasby. I've never said that before. on the other side, truly an honorable individual, I'm sure, John McArdle, Mayor of Independence, and well, Judge Grassley is the mayor of Harney County, or the judge of Harney County. Additionally, I'm going to invite up Mary MacArthur, who is staff for three regional boards. She's brought one of her board members or another staff along with her, and we really don't have room for everybody at the table, but as soon as we can, I'll get out of the way and they can move on up here. The regional and rural investment programs are programs that have created a framework for local state cooperation and economic development issues. There are 13 regional boards doing business out there. They're helping us advance the state's mission of sustainable quality jobs for all Oregonians at least cost. For the regions, the programs, I think, provide critical funding to leverage job creation efforts and provide a way to fund local capacity. For the state, especially the current version, which mandates job creation and leverage, has created a critical conversation about how to advance job creation efforts and specific projects and leverage the department's staff. Essentially, we're more than doubling the amount of effort going on in terms of economic development through the regional boards and their staffs.
What's in the budget? How much are you folks allocating?
$10.6 million.
How does that compare to where you were a decade ago?
If you'll bear with me just a second, I'm about to talk about history.
I just asked a question.
The A decade ago, well, the current $7.1 million is the all-time low for the program. The $10.6 million would be the second lowest funding level for the program.
Okay.
It does represent a 50% increase, and while I'm sure people would be happy to receive more money, it is one of the largest percentage increases in the governor's budget. So in that regard, the department's happy. The history of the program was created in 1987. It was at that time a department-operated program. Regions applied to the department for assistance. The commission selected projects, and the department managed the projects. By 1999, the program had evolved to a point where it was basically the legislature was telling the department, hands off. The regions get to establish their own targets, their own performance measures to measure the performance of those targets, and they're going to go do their thing. We believe, the department believes, that with new direction from the legislature in 2003, as I said, targeting job creation, leverage, and wage levels, we have a very effective and efficient economic development tool that has, as I said, a bunch of people working on behalf of...
Can you determine who gets credit for the jobs?
I'll wrap up, and part of the results I'm going to talk about are the jobs, and I'll explain the two totals that we're coming up with. We turned the ship last time. You gave us new directions. It took us a while to do that. There were complaints about that. At this point, I'm committing to a streamlined checklist on getting the program going next time, subject to no legislative changes, which is our recommendation, because we believe the program works. We believe we can deliver it quickly, get the money on the ground, and get rolling out of the box early next time. And we're willing to sign on the dotted line to that end, and we're willing to publish our performance toward that, and we'll publish it to the regions on a weekly basis and to interested legislatures, should there be any. The results we've seen so far this biennium were based on funding decisions made through the end of the calendar year of 2004. At that time, the regions had committed almost half the money, or just over half the money. From their perspective, to get to your question, they were creating 3,000 jobs. The decisions they made were made on the basis of people saying, we're going to create 3,000 or retain 3,000 jobs and leverage $150 million of other investment. These are huge performance results.
Just so I'm clear and the committee's clear, for $10 million, we were able to take credit for
Under $4 million. This is half of the $7 million.
Okay, so for $4 million, we were able to take credit for 3,000 jobs.
They made decisions for 3,000. Now you ask, how do we track that? The department, in order to avoid double counting, prorates jobs based on where the money came from on a percentage basis. By that methodology, which was approved by the legislature in 1999, the department was giving the program credit for 1,700 jobs, 1,701 jobs, I believe. But remember, the boards made decisions that in their mind were leading to the creation or retention of 3,000 jobs. So there was two numbers.
What happens if a company starts at the SPDC? And the SPDC says, you need to go talk to the regional board, and the regional board says, we like this, here's some seed money.
Then
they send it to the business development fund. How do you track that?
That's exactly the proration I'm talking about. We would identify each of the programs that the agency operates, so legislatively approved money through the agency. We'd figure out how much of that on a cost basis came from each of the programs, and we'd divide mathematically to get to the results. So just in a quick and dirty version, if there was $75,000 and $25,000 came from the regional board, $50,000 came from strategic reserve fund, let's say, or any loan program, whatever. The expectation was 30 jobs that would be created. Having contributed one-third of the money, the regional board would get credit for one-third of the jobs. And since the business finance program, if it were, had contributed two-thirds of the money, the business finance program would get credit for two-thirds of the jobs. We're reporting these both ways. In the wrap-up of Department of Investments, we're showing the prorated numbers. In the reports that I've distributed to you, we're showing the decision that the regional board made as well. So if that's
really quick,
satisfies the questions of me, I'm going to pass it on to my partners.
I have some more
just
questions.
One more.
Representative
Bucky. Any sense of how permanent or long-standing these jobs are?
Chair Smith, Representative Vakian, we asked the regional boards to project how long it's going to take to create the jobs, and then we ask them to track for 2 years after that. So every 6 months, the department collects reports from the regional boards, wherein they tell us of the investments that were made sometime in the past that are still to be on the table within that how long you need to get there plus 2 years window. And they report to us everything that's on the table for that period of time.
So, may I?
Please.
So the 3,000 jobs that we've been talking about, is it fair for me to assume that those are at least two-year jobs in length?
Chair Smith, Representative Avakian, that's exactly the case. We will require them to report for at least 2 years what happens. And we'll track it.
I think I understand, but I just want to make sure. But you're assuming that those are permanent positions. You're assuming that 50% of those are not two-year contractual jobs, that after that we don't know. But you track it for 2 years, and we're assured that at least those 3,000 or so are at least that or better.
Chair Smith, Representative Hawkins, that's
okay.
Correct.
Thank you.
Mr. Burton, just quick, what would you think about the idea if this body said, we just want to make sure any business who's going to receive regional rural has a plan? A business plan. Would you be okay to that?
Chair Smith, there are significant history with this program about policy decisions that have been made. I would want to make that decision in consultation with the customers who use the program. And it would be wonderful if we could do that with the legislature at the table.
Wait a minute. No, I'm not letting you off the hook. Do you think it's a good idea for the state of Oregon, who's going to grant money to somebody, to say, can we see your business plan?
Chair Smith, I believe that in almost all of these cases, the regional boards are asking for a business plan that's already being done. I believe it is good business.
Okay, thank you. Let me ask one other question. Once you look at a business plan, do you think it's a, what would your take be on the state of Oregon saying, you know, before we grant money, we just want to make sure that we've considered all avenues in terms of loaning you the money first? Kind of like what you do with Special Public Works or some of the other programs.
Chair Smith, I encourage the boards to do that on an ongoing basis.
Okay. So just from your take, you would have no problem if this committee said, you know, let's just make sure every business who's going to get money from the state has a business plan, and we look at loaning them money first, and then we fill the gap with equity or any other needs with grant dollars.
Chair Smith, the department does that for our own investments, and we encourage our customers to do it as well.
Okay. Thank you. Welcome. Judge, thank you for driving all this way and being patient.
You bet. Good afternoon. For the record, I am Steve Gresty. I'm Harney County Judge, and I also chair the Southeast Regional Alliance, Malheur, Harney, and Grant Counties. And, yes, it was a long ways. Yesterday, the Regional Alliance met in John Day, and so I got my 400 miles and a lengthy meeting in yesterday. But this is important stuff, and it's a reason to be here.
Did you tell Mr. Minster hi for me?
Yes.
Thank you. He's a good man.
Yes. I am hugely supportive of regional and rural investment program and think it needs to be kept there. Hopefully, before I get down, I can respond to the last two questions you asked because I have some insight about it. Last biennium, the legislature did set job creation as an agenda for these programs. Rural Oregon knew that about 3 years ahead, and we'd long before set those. That is our goal for the investment of these dollars. And, yeah, we're very focused on long term. We're not interested in creating a job that lasts for 6 months and reporting it to anybody. We want something that's there and helps our economy long term. Let me tell two short stories if I can. Yesterday, in the Rural Alliance meeting in John Day, we awarded up to $100,000 to a meat processing plant in John Day. That plant's going to create 20 new jobs. It's already created 14, I believe. It's added value to a basic commodity out there, to beef, that's produced in Grant County and in the region. It's received a USDA certification this week. It's environmentally clean, and it's homegrown. This week, it's handling 38 beef, and if all goes well, it will grow to 6,000 head a year with a single shift. The plant has the capacity to go to two shifts and double the workforce. Additionally, HASM will continue to create jobs for transporting the beef in and out and contracted sales jobs in the state and across the nation, if you would, as well. It's a local rancher teamed with a very small financial institution in John Day. And they've committed over $1.2 million invested into the plant. So the leverage is 12 to 1. And this truly was the final gap in funding they needed to make this work.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
May I ask a question just so I can follow what appears to be an obvious success story? The businessman went to the bank and must have demonstrated his capability to deliver a business plan, those things that a commercial lending institution would take a look at, and you in your $100,000 grant then were just closing the gap between what the commercial institution was willing to do and what was needed to move this business forward?
That's right. There was a business plan, and is there really a business case for the amount of money that's initially invested? Some of this is speculation, without a doubt. And that institution was willing to go out on a limb considerably.
The bank was.
The bank and that rancher. That's right.
But the piece that I'm trying to get here, and I think you've answered it, is that this is not simply making a grant. There has been some fiscal pro forma that has been reviewed by people who are in the business of reviewing business documents. Somebody has talked to the rancher about the risks involved in this. This is a knowledgeable businessman with the tools in his toolbox that you would expect from someone seeking a standard commercial loan.
Yeah, absolutely. And the Southeast Regional Alliance has two bankers and a retired hospital administrator as our financial committee. They've reviewed all the confidential information, and they make a recommendation to the Alliance prior to us awarding the money. That's why I said up to. Yesterday we awarded $53,000 and said we will put another $47,000 in, provided the last couple of questions from the financial committee are answered, if you would.
Good. Just to put a fine point, or maybe beat it to death, I'm one of the two. What I'm trying to get onto the record is that this was a very thoughtfully made extension of credit or a grant that leveraged other money. I'm trying to distinguish this from the perception that some people hold of the agency, that if you know the right folks, you just scoot in and you leave with a check for $100,000. And I am trying to develop in this discussion with you the background that clearly underlies an extension of financial support of the magnitude that you're discussing.
Senator, I think I'd say that almost to the contrary. We were somewhat dubious about, is there a business case here? And so we did ask a lot of questions. Had this person gone to another financial institution, I doubt they could have secured a loan of any type. It was the last resort to fill that gap in to make this project happen.
And the rancher has something on the line, a personal guarantee?
He has all his cattle and everything that he owns personally. He's part of a family ranch. He's not and can't commit the assets of the family to his personal. He's got everything on the line.
Thank you. That's very instructive.
Do you think that's fair?
I think it's more than fair. The business I started years ago, I had everything except my kids on the line. So.
And that could have happened.
Hindsight.
Let me ask one more question. We're talking some pretty large dollars. Do you feel like the board is qualified to make those type of decisions?
I'm quickly running through who sits on that board. Yes, I do. A number of those people have make this would not be a large financial decision on their part from experience that they've made over the years.
Okay. So earlier I was talking about the need to make sure there's a business plan and have alternative sources of financing looked at, so when the folks on the board have a project come forward, they're able to determine whether a business plan is good or not.
Yes, nothing comes before us without a business plan. We're, we've had that drummed into ourselves. I'm a broken record about San Wilshire's business plan. It doesn't need to be state policy. We understand that. We're not going to let it happen without it. If it's state policy, bless his heart, but Mr. Burton's going to spend weeks looking at it, and it's just going to slow the process down. And he's a good friend, but we got the message.
I think what we want to do is just make sure the message coming out of this committee is that we want to make sure that everybody gets a fair shake, and that there's a good, thoughtful plan behind each and every project. And I think the case is made, but at the same time, we're responsible for answering to a lot of Oregonians, and we want to be able to say, you know, we know they're doing that. So, thank you. Welcome.
Good morning, or good afternoon. Hello. I'm John McArdle. I'm the chairperson of the Mid-Willamette Valley Community Development Partnership Board that serves Marion, Polk, and Yamhill County. I'm also the mayor of Independence and a recent past president of the Oregon Mayors Association. I'm going to try to do this in about 2 minutes. Our partnership board is made up of 14 elected local leaders and 14 business leaders, very similar to the previous testimony. And we serve as both the Regional Investment Board and the Federally Chartered Economic Development District. And first of all, on behalf of our partnership board, thank you. And we really appreciate the work of this committee, the past session, and the confidence that you've shown to local leaders by continuing to support the rural and regional investment programs. And engaging business leaders and local officials in the process of directing these important public investments is very powerful. By working together regionally and across jurisdictional industry boundaries, we've made very good use of these funds. Just the approximately $700,000 awarded by our board in the past year will contribute to the creation of at least 300 new jobs and more than $38 million in new investments in the community. And because you folks have allowed flexibility in the program and trusted we local stakeholders to make good investments, we've been able to hone in on particular economic opportunities and challenges in the Mid-Willamette Valley. We've also been able to adjust quickly to economic conditions. In the program's earliest years, as was mentioned earlier, we focused these funds on two activities that most strategically benefited our agricultural sector: matching marketing grants to companies that help expand their national and international sales, and assistance to the development of more housing for farm workers. During the boom of the 90s, we made more resources available to help communities address infrastructure problems and other growth-related demands. And more recently, in the economically challenging period we were just ending, we've returned at the legislative direction to activities that are more intended to directly spur new investment and job growth. Now, we take the word partnership in our name very, very seriously. We carefully consult with state agencies, OECD, and others in our grant award process so we don't duplicate other resources or miss opportunities for additional investment. We encourage local governments to collaborate on projects so there's greater impact and less duplication. And in the past round of rural investment grants, for example, we financed a region-wide inventory and analysis of all industrial sites in rural areas to determine their potential for participation in the Oregon Industrial Site Certification Program. We provided a single grant to a number of small communities in the North San Yam Canyon to help with a micro-enterprise program. We provided a single grant to the cities of Dallas, Monmouth, Independence to help them jointly market their industrial sites. Now, how do we do this? What really happens is the proposal comes in, staff review it at the Council of Governments, and then we have a peer review. The group, the partnership board, is made up of elected officials and business people, and we really chew on these things. And we all know that it's going to one area or another area, there's a request, and it's got to pass the smell test, folks, because, you know, if it's going over there, that means it can't go over to my community, to another business. So we really put it through a real ringer and take a look at it. And for businesses receiving grants, we perform a financial review and require the guarantee the grantees to sign a note that turns the grant into a loan if they don't create the promised number of jobs. I urge you to continue this kind of a program. It really makes a difference. The partnership really works. It's good. It's made a difference in our community, and we need to continue it at the level the governor requested. Thank you. Did I do it in 2 minutes?
That's pretty darn good.
I work on it.
For an elected official.
Hey, but I have a real job in my real life, too, so I'm a volunteer.
Well, let me ask you this question.
Yes, sir.
Talk a little bit about the leverage. Give me examples, or give this committee examples, of how you've leveraged rural and regional dollars for projects.
Sometimes the dollars that are in... Yeah.
we put some money in and we see what the other dollars that are going to come in. We ask that as part of the application form. You know, where are we going to get that? Sometimes you can put money in and get additional dollars, and there's personal investment, there's company investment, there's municipal investment. A lot of times what was mentioned earlier was gap financing. Sometimes it's putting that little bit in that can really leverage things. I was just looking through during the earlier parts of the testimony, you know, estimated matching and leveraging of funds. $36,700 was matched and leveraged against $367,000.
So do you think it's a good idea, recognizing the diversity of your projects, that the projects you review have a plan for how they're going to be done and how they're going to be implemented in the future?
Absolutely. You know, how does anything get done if you don't have a plan? And so, yes, they all have a plan, and they have to hold. We're holding everybody else accountable. You know, it's a group action, and we're holding everybody accountable, and it's got to fly.
Terrific. I'm glad to hear you talk about partnership and the notion of having a plan for operation, because these are, after all, public dollars, and we need to make sure they're maximized and that we hold folks accountable for their use.
Thank you,
Senator Carter.
Pardon my being late, juggling too many meetings. Anyway, so thank you for your testimony. Can you tell me how do we more effectively, as a state with our partners, determine how many jobs are being developed as a result of the monies that we spend in the state, and how can the system work more effectively in terms of that information coming to the state when it gets back to the legislature? We're not always doing this because we can't tell how many jobs have been developed as a result of the dollars that are spent through the Oregon Economic Development Department.
Counting. And I'm going to, you want to take.
Well, of course, he's a policy person. He can tell us that, but how can you do it? How can you do it at the local level? Yeah. We can talk to him and ask him. We can ask Mike that. Mike, and I feel comfortable. I'm not trying to get anything, but that's the thing. Yeah, I've been here for 20 years. You know, I was the second person to chair the committee on trade and economic development. And we've always had the problem with how can our local partners get information to us in terms of how many jobs are being developed as a result of our partnership. And then we can come back with our chest all stuck out and say, legislature, you should refund this again, because we can tell you the jobs that are being developed out there. We can tell you how effective the program is being. We don't have to hold our heads down and always have a fuss about reorganizing, reconstituting the Department of Economic Development. Does that make sense?
Judge Grassley.
I'd like to play on some earlier conversation out of this. One is the interim committee. I think that's a wonderful idea, and I think it's not under the gun to do this kind of thing. I also think the opportunities for local leaders like ourselves to come here and tell you the story, tell you what happened in our communities. It's so much easier in a Harney County than it might be in a Portland with 20 jobs there. It's just this incredible impact in our community. It takes 2,800 in Portland to be equivalent to that. So for much of Oregon, it's pretty easy for us as county leaders and city leaders to come and tell the story. If you want to hear that in that manner, we can do it. When you have in front of you about four trees worth of paper, but this is a document that gets us fairly well up to date, telling our story in this. But it's compiled in bureaucracy language. So.
Let's move on. Welcome, ladies.
I'm Mary MacArthur, and I'm actually staffed of three different regional investment boards and one economic development district in Northwest Oregon. And I'm here in my official role to introduce one of our partners in the Mount Hood Economic Alliance. But I just want to also echo what you've heard today. I've been involved with the regional investment program since its inception, since 1987. I have watched it go through all the trials, the tribulations, the ups, the downs, the change in the goalposts, everything. It is working now. Senator Carter, you mentioned about how do you track those jobs. We now have to track them through the Oregon Employment Department. We have to, from every employer that we give money to, we have to get quarterly copies of their Oregon employment reports. We see physically what those jobs are. We get a baseline measurement before the project starts, and we track those every 3 months. We are now on track with the department in terms of our reporting to them. The contracting process, as Mike mentioned, is a straightforward kind of program schedule, and it's working. And I guess what I want to
tell me what works best.
Right now, what's working best is actually the legislative overview of requiring jobs and leverage to be the primary focuses. That helps in terms of the applications we get, and it helps in terms of our contracting, and it helps in terms of having documentable performance reporting. There is no gray area. It is black and white what we have to do.
How much time do you spend on a report?
The last report was very quick. I bet I didn't spend more than a couple of hours for each region on the last reporting. The department has put together an automated program that you just plug in the numbers and it calculates forward everything that you need to have. So it is slick. It's working. It's great. The other piece is that we also, in the three regions I work with, all require business plans. Everything these guys have said is there. My recommendations, don't fiddle with it. It's working now. It's taken us 15 years or more to get there. It's working. Let's continue to the mark.
What's it working for?
I would say specifically it's working for our, what I call our customers, and that's our businesses. We have an online application that includes all of our requirements, that includes the parameters, the decision-making criteria that they don't even bother to apply if they can't meet the leverage requirements and the job retention and creation requirements. It's there. It also links us with our partners, the local economic development people, and in the Northwest region, it links it with our loan officer, so that that individual can do all the due diligence, financial due diligence on our project. So.
Do you folks look at, after you review a business plan, do you first look at loaning money before granting?
Yes.
Where do those loan dollars come from?
What we'll do is we'll start out using the regional rural investment dollars that we have been allocated, use that as our capitalization, loan them out, and then when they revolve, come back in, then we revolve them back out as a revolving loan fund. I would like to introduce Shelley Perini, and she is the manager of the Clackamas County Business and Economic Development Team.
Good afternoon, Chair Smith and committee. And I'm going to make this very brief because I don't think there's really that much more that I can add than what you've already heard. But one thing I found that's missing, we've talked a lot today about job creation and industrial lands, and really one of the key points in these funds that I've been impressed, I've been with Clackamas County now for about a year, and for those who don't know, Clackamas County is primarily a rural county, and we have the largest number in farms in the state of Oregon, and only 1/8 of our region is actually urban. And so it's kind of unique that I've had this opportunity to see these funds put into play coming from the more urban community and really helping some of our smaller towns. Because one of the points that I heard here was very, very true. To some small communities, the ability to help an existing company add 7 new jobs is critical than having the existing 10 walk away because they can't compete in a global economy. My partners for the Mountain Hood Economic Alliance is Wasco and Hood County, and once again, because of our rural nature, it makes a really good strategic partnership. And I have had the opportunity, coming from the more rural or the more urban side of the fence, watching the evolution of the Regional Investment Board funds, and I'm very impressed that they are tracking the return on investment directly to jobs, because that's the accountability it should be. And one of the things I particularly like about these funds is that all businesses, whether it's a small, we have a small entrepreneur who's handicapped out in Eagle Creek who has a ribbon business, and she needed a very small capital startup. And so we were able to provide her with a small loan to help her be able to become self-sufficient from her home. On the same hand, one of my other partners was able to help Google site in their community. And so what's nice about these funds, unlike an enterprise zone or many of these other special government programs, is that every business, regardless of their size, regardless of their geography, has access to support And in a business climate where 85% of our job growth is coming from existing businesses, it just makes a smart partnership to be able to leverage and use these funds. And so just to make sure I'm honoring my partners, I have to let you know that we've helped over 10 companies this year. We've created 169 new jobs in the region. We've approximately one job for every $3,000 worth of funding. Using approximately $480,000 in Regional Investment Board funds, the Mount Hood Economic Alliance Board has leveraged $2.5 million additional investment, or approximately $5 in new investment for every dollar funded. And I just want to end by saying once again, adding 5 to 20 new jobs at a time may not seem a lot, but it can seem like a lifeline to a small community or to a small person who is forced to be able to find an entrepreneurial way to work from home. So on behalf of the Mount Hood Economic Alliance, thanks for having me here.
Thank you. Senator Johnson.
Thank you. Thanks very much, Mary. It's very nice to see you. I've had the privilege of working with you, and I appreciate everything you do. The question that I have in looking at the report that was passed out, the Regional Investment Board's response, have you seen this?
Mm-hmm.
In looking at them, and without getting too specific on the record here, I noticed one in your area that didn't perform. And my curiosity is, when there is an investment, in this case it was $90,000 from the Regional Investment that leveraged another 1.6, and it didn't perform, how is that money, what efforts do you make to try to recoup that money, or what happens to it?
Well, I guess the bottom line, and particularly on that one, we did not recoup it. It was a situation where we thought it was good. We had gone in with the best intentions, and I think we are not in the business of competing with banks. And consequently, we're going to end up probably with a higher risk kinds of business investments. And hopefully most of the time it's going to work out, and we're going to have our misses. And this was a miss. And we had done all of our due diligence. We had set up the contracting. There was no resources to go back after, I mean, in terms of trying to recoup.
When you say no resources, presumably there was a superior lien on the physical assets, and
we are always the last in line, particularly because we're not a bank. We are gap financing. In all of these cases, we are never more than a 20% financer at best. Many times we're less than that, and we're always the last in line. That was a tough one for a little region.
Yeah, I know it very well, and it was a tough one all the way around. My question shouldn't be implied as a criticism, because in the line of work that you're in, you win some and you don't win some. What I'm trying to get my finger on is, for the nature of the investing that you're doing, which by your admission, and I think anybody's admission, is high risk, all of the safeguards that are put in place to try to recoup a public investment when it doesn't work, and at least some acknowledgement that there are as many recovery mechanisms there as possible to try to put $90,000 back in the system that, in this instance, is gone. And
but are you talking about the Instepus?
Yeah.
We didn't do 90.
Is all I'm doing is just reading it off the sheet.
We were going to do 90 if if they were able to go forward. We invested $5,000 in technical assistance, and it turned out they failed.
And that's it.
That's it. No, we dodged the bullet on that.
Okay.
Not in a good sense either, because we want the company. We wanted the company.
I know you meant the company succeeded, but instead of where I'm reading this, that has
this was
90 investment and another 1.6 leveraged, and I was trying to figure out what happens to this money. And your response is, we never got that far.
We invested $5,000 first to make sure our financial due diligence was going to play off, and as it turned out, they did not.
Actually, out of a very sad situation, that is a wonderful answer.
It is a sad situation.
Thank you.
Very sad.
Thank you.
What I'm going to do is bring up Representative Butler and Commissioner McLeod. And Lisa, do you want to come up as well? Come on up. Welcome. What I'm going to do is, because of Chair Butler's schedule, I'm going to let him speak first, and then we'll go to folks from the great District of 57. So, welcome, Chair Butler.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thank you. I've got to have a flower on here next to this thorn so that you'll be able to tell which. And this isn't the thorn.
I know that's not.
And why the flower on the lapel, Chair Butler?
This morning when I woke up, I started my 60th year on this earth. That's what that's all about. My birthday was yesterday, but I was only 59. I'm Tom Butler from House District 60, and thank you very much for the opportunity of coming forward. We have particularly House Bill 838, which is an attempt to try and make sure that Oregon's economy has an opportunity to grow with family wage jobs. Oregon's economy does depend upon the creation of family wage jobs in a variety of industries. In our global economy of today, we really have to continue to create new products and add new value to existing products or to find new ways to be more productive. We need to do all of this through innovation. We can only produce so much from our natural resources with the inhibitors that we have in place right now. While we would like to open up our natural resource industry, we'll do the best we can through innovation. That's why we have linked three key elements to House Bill 838. First, we increase our research and our ability to create new ideas. And last session, we developed the concept of ONAMI. And I want to acknowledge members of both sides of the House and the Senate, on both sides of the aisle, that came together to help us with the ONAMI, where we were able to take a $1 million investment, leverage it 35 times for the benefit of the state of Oregon. Next, we really must make it easier for universities and small business, as well as entrepreneurs, to make their ideas available to the market, to commercialize this research into new Oregon products and Oregon businesses. And here we're asking for $2 million in our model. Finally, third, we must do a better job of connecting the pieces within our innovation economy, and this bill establishes the Oregon Innovation Council, which will not only develop a comprehensive state plan for innovation economy, but will coordinate and show us how to successfully link these programs together. Now, I think it's important, Chair Smith and members of the committee, to distinguish between the differences between, number one, basic research allocation funding of higher education, and that's in part what you're considering coming through the full ways and means, but also ONAMI's specific focus on commercialization research for an array of Oregon industries. I wish to make three key points in that regard. Number one, the innovation economy is all about creating jobs, high-paid jobs, in a variety of sectors of industries within the state of Oregon. Number two, by linking that research, the economic development, and through the Economic Development Department, it's critical and important that we have that piece, we keep our existing businesses on a competitive edge while creating these new entities and investing opportunities in the state of Oregon. And finally, I want you to recognize that this is not an urban versus rural issue. I frequently use the line that I'm not sure why I continue to vote yes on bringing light rail to Portland. We don't get our cows to the market on light rail. I'm not sure how you folks in Portland do it, but we don't use the light rail. But I know that it's important, and I know that that's how we're going to bridge this divide. It's for me to recognize that you have special needs in the urban area, and I have some different and special needs in that.
So glad you said that.
Thank you very much. So I see this as a reason to have co-sponsored Senate Bill 838 to see if we can't strive to move these innovative issues in two sessions as opposed to just the last session. And I sincerely encourage your full support for the $9 million being $2 million for the commercialized research and $7 million for UNAMI. And folks, if we can just do 10 times next round, that would still be excellent. But I got a sneaking suspicion that based upon what's happening in the state of Oregon with regard to the commercialized research today, that you can still expect about a 20-time return in the state of Oregon on our current economy, and perhaps greater. I'd like to see it at another 35. I don't know that we can sustain that kind of force, but at least we can create those high-paying family wage jobs that we're looking for throughout Oregon. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Thank you, Chair Butler. Let me ask you this question. What happens if the committee only funded half?
Mr. Chair, I'm anticipating that the chair can, that the committee could certainly do that. I also recognize that half a loaf is better than none, and also that I would want to make absolutely certain with our partners on the ONAMI and the Commercialized Research Group that you don't ask us to try and see if we can jump the Grand Canyon in two leaps.
Always been a wise man, Tom.
Smarter as he's older.
That's right.
Sometimes you don't jump. Thank you very much. Commissioner Tallman, and then we'll go to Commissioner McLeod. Commissioner Tallman.
Thank you very much, Chair Smith, and members of the committee. We appreciate being able to speak today. I'll be very, very brief. This is testimony today that's being presented here in Salem on behalf of, let me just back up. My name's Terry Tallman. I'm Morrow County Judge and County Commissioner of Morrow County. This is testimony being presented on behalf of the Baker-Morrow Regional Rural Partnership. Fred Warner, County Commissioner and Chair in Baker County, is a co-chair. There's Baker County's Regional Rural Board and Morrow County's Regional Rural Board as well. We have six board members on each side. Members have there's bankers, there's engineers, there's farmers, there's ranchers, there's folks, PGE employees, there's folks from almost every walk of life on that board. We also are staffed by Greater Eastern Oregon Development Corporation, and I want to say definitely that I fully appreciate all the time and effort given by staff to prepare the budgets and the reports that are where they keep them balanced and try to get them back to the state in a timely manner. Our board takes very seriously the requirements given to us by the last legislature. As you can see by our report, we are very close to meeting our goals at the beginning of this biennium. We are confident that we will exceed the goals that we have set for ourselves by the end of this biennium. There's a second sheet that I gave that will kind of lay out what I'm talking about there. I just say my request is to increase the funding level to the regional rural investment programs. These programs have met and will exceed the set goals and are a part of the reason for the recovery we are beginning to see in the state of Oregon. We want to push these efforts forward into the next biennium, but we need your approval. I have included a copy of the latest report that we have to us as a board. I think, Senator Carter, this report kind of lays out some of the questions that you were asking about. That fourth column there says total number of jobs proposed, total number of jobs attributed to the partnership, and then total number of jobs. We have a third column there that says family wage jobs. And then the difference then is the prorated jobs that Mike Burton was talking about there. So as you can see there, down there in that middle box, we have 66 jobs on the $1 to $5,000 ratio. Our 5 to 1 leveraged fund ratio, we're at the 164 to 1 area, and we have created, in terms of family wage jobs, our goal was to create 33, and we have 34.4 on a prorated basis. So we, I think, have met the spirit and intent of the law.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Johnson.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner. It's very nice to see you again.
Yes.
You described the composition of your board, which is impressive. Who's the appointing authority for the board, and how do new names come forward for consideration?
The county commissioners in each county are responsible, and whenever someone is indicating to us that maybe they want to move off the board, we begin to go about seeking names from, we may publish it, we may ask in communities, we try to spread it out throughout the county geographically, and so we ask city councils, we ask people that we know, we try to keep it balanced so that we don't create problems for ourselves that way politically.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Please.
Are there term limits on your board so that you refresh the board periodically, or is there a limitation on how long someone can serve?
We haven't officially set a term limit. Generally, people, about 2 years is enough for them. And so, by about that time, we have a recycling that takes place.
Thanks.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you. Thank you, Judge. Commissioner.
Good afternoon, Chairman Smith and members of the committee. My name is Colleen McLeod. I'm a county commissioner from Eastern Oregon, as well as a longtime member of the Northeast Oregon Alliance Board. And I've brought Lisa Dawson with me today. She is the director of Northeast Oregon Economic Development and staff to our regional board. So if you ask really hard questions, I won't look foolish. She knows everything. I have both watched and been an active participant in the process of fixing Oregon's economy for most of the last decade. I'm a commissioner in Union County, where we are known for our active and successful participation in the repair and attempted renewal of a once thriving natural resource-based region. And I will tell you, just in listening to the talk today, I want to say that neither Mr. Brantley or Mr. Burton are paying me to say this, but we have certainly found over the duration that the department is there to help those who want to help themselves, and they have been a very good partner to Union County in trying to revive our economy, and our unemployment levels have shown that over time. Over time, our alliance of three counties, and that's Union, Wallowa, and Umatilla, have forged a strong working relationship. We don't fight over money to take home to the county we represent, but actually champion projects for their merit, not their geography. And I think that, Senator, is the answer to do we have short terms that people are allowed to serve? We have people that have been there longer than I am, and they know, they've seen the changes come around, and they know the merits of a project. And I think there's a strength in that.
Mr. Chair, just for clarification, I wasn't advocating, because I think the loss of an institutional history is very seriously negative. What I was just trying to feel out was how often and through what mechanism there's an opportunity for people willing and able to serve to come forward.
Right, and we don't have a lot of people to recycle, so we use them as long as we can. We have followed the up and down funding allocations and requirements of each passing legislature, and we've tried to make the case and remind the legislature each funding cycle that rural Oregon has been forced to redesign its own ability to exist, and we have such a long way to go. As a regional board, we find ourselves often in defense mode of our job number ratios if they're not the state norm. We feel pressure to defend expenditures on needed infrastructure because they don't have that immediate job creation component. And I understand you having to defend your expenditures, and job creation is a really good measure. But infrastructure sometimes to us in redesigning our economy is just as important. Let me address counting jobs. One funding cycle, we spend a portion of our allocation on a point of presence for Union County. That's a link to the World Wide Web. We didn't have one. That did not create an immediate job total for reporting, but it propelled my county into the 21st century. It gave us the beginnings of an unparalleled telecommunications network, two additional phone companies, which now we have three, countless business expansions, the immediate location of Oregon Dental Services to downtown LaGrande, and now ODS's expansion and construction of a new building and dental school in the downtown area. It was also the needed impetus to construct our new $35 million science and technology facility at Eastern Oregon University and a new technology business park to complement that. How do you count those jobs? You can't put another T. Every time a T1 line for telecommunications comes into LaGrande, it's bought. That is expansion. That's job creation. We attempt progress with less and less investment dollars to encourage new growth and little extra to accommodate the staff time required for the time-consuming but required paperwork and reporting. We do not seek your sympathy, but just your respect. That respect ought to come in the form of trusting us in both the process and with adequate and respectable and consistent funding. Chair Smith, you asked how this process has evolved. We are encouraged by your efforts to call attention to our skills and accomplishments out in the regions and your efforts to entrust us with more responsibility for our own futures. Those of us who live out in our regions and work on the growth of our economies know which projects will be a wise investment. We know which proposals will fill gaps and which ones our communities will respond to. We know when to loan and we know when to grant. We know how to leverage additional funding dollars, and we're proud of our successful track record. We have been doing this long enough to be quite well trained in the process of growing Oregon's economy. And as an all-volunteer board members in the effort, we end up being a pretty good infrastructure investment of employees for the state. Although hope springs eternal, I am realistic enough to know we will probably never return to the needed funding levels of $20.6 million that we enjoyed in the 99-01 cycle. But let me please remind you these dollars have to stretch statewide, and I ask that you at least honor the governor's recommended amount of $10.6 million for this biennium. We are going to need more investment in infrastructure. We are out of heavy industrial land in my county. That's how do you create more jobs and have a ratio to do that when you can't expand your urban growth boundary and you can't get more heavy industrial land? We're not done with infrastructure yet.
Do you view yourself as a constituent or a partner of the state of Oregon?
Of the state, we are definitely a partner.
Do you feel like...
We spend our money, too.
Do you think in terms of economic development that the counties ought to have a seat at the table in determining how economic development is...
Kind of the way I see it, the counties have been sort of de facto made economic development professionals in the state just because of lottery funding. We get a portion of that. We spend ours on economic development. It has made us a partner in our cities and in our county, in the region, and with the state as well. We don't ask the state to put money into something that we don't put money into first. So we are partners, truly.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Who wants to go first? Why don't we
get
Lisa,
okay.
Do you want to...
I do not have any prepared testimony.
Perfect. She's we're just going in. It's very good seeing you. Now, how far did you have to drive to get here?
Tell her what time you got up.
I left at 4:30. I got up at 4:30, left at 5 this morning.
Jeez, yeah.
It's important.
Senator Decker, come on up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm not going to, because I'm on Onami, which you've already heard, so I won't, other than say Ryan Deckard, State Senate District 14 Beaverton. You have heard a lot about Onami and the commercialization opportunities, the private and federal dollars that it's leveraging, and you'll hear more from people who are better to address this than myself. The one thing that I would note, because obviously I've been involved in Onami and the incredible success it is enjoying, is that just today in today's paper I was reading the head of Intel Venture Capital is located here in Oregon, and that's an incredible boon for our state that folks really don't know about, but it's one of the largest venture funds in the world, and it's here in, or the head of it is here in Oregon, and they asked him, well, what's going right in Oregon right now? And he mentioned all the usuals, tax, you know, what should Oregon do? And he mentioned all the usuals, taxes and education. But the third thing he said was Onami, which I think was certainly, I definitely took note of that, that Onami, that investing in nano and micro technology in one of the core areas that Oregon's actually good at and has some competency in, and the commercialization opportunities and the jobs that will be created, to me, but the fact that Mr. Miner observed that and noted it was another verification of the success Onami's bringing us. So I appreciate the time.
Let me ask you this question, Senator, and we appreciate you coming to this committee hearing. Is there an opportunity for Onami to benefit the entire state of Oregon?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think absolutely. Onami is focused on what is Oregon, I mean, and some of the technologies that are, because I think when people hear Onami, they think Intel might be involved. In many ways, this is not for your established semiconductor industries. It's for the kidney dialysis machine that is a small startup company. But we really believe that it's going to be natural resource based. The idea behind Onami is just that things, our new products in the new millennia are going to be smaller. They're going to be smaller projects. And so whether that's fuel cell generation, or kidney dialysis, or I really think, I mean, a lot of the folks that are really involved in Onami believe a lot of it's going to be in your natural resources, particularly agriculture, the new technologies.
One of the areas I struggled with, and I spent the last couple nights, reading about this, is I think everyone has a different definition of what innovation is. And I think part of what can help the state is to help create a definition of innovation so everyone is on the same page. Is that something that the legislature can assist the state in, is helping to create a definition of innovation?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, innovation is our ability to compete. As you know, land and labor are no longer our big assets in a global economy, and so we are as good as our innovation is. Innovating new products and new ideas is our only in the legislature. This committee actually is the one that will lead the charge in that.
And innovation could occur in a small business. It could occur in a big business. It could occur on the coast. It could occur in Southern Oregon.
Yeah, I would say probably small businesses where you're going to see it. All of these are going to be small business related, 2 to 10 people where they're startups.
What I would share with you, Chair Deckard, is that work on, for us, for some of us folks who innovation is new to, if you could help us understand the concept and getting your hands around what is innovation. Because I think your comments hit it right on the head. Some folks think it's purely high-tech benefiting Intel, and I'm not sure that's the case.
It's not, yeah.
So. Senator Johnson, I need you to stay. And I have an appointment right now in the speaker's office for 10 minutes.
I knew I could outwait him and get the gavel. Bring it over here.
And there's only one person on this entire committee I truly trust with the gavel, and it is Senator Johnson. I will be back in about 10 minutes.
Chair Johnson,
I'm going to stay for a
Chair Smith, Chair
now.
Johnson, I have a suggestion. We have invited guests to speak on ports issues and innovation as well as remaining folks in Region Rural. If you would be patient and remain here, we could forego or delay our testimony so that you could hear that.
I would like that very much. I know I have some constituents in the audience who've driven a long ways, and there are others that have come a great distance. I'm going to ask Robin to give me the witness list if they're signed up, and in the meantime, anybody who has come from a long ways away, get ready to talk.
I'm going to jump in just a little bit. Before you two gentlemen speak, can I ask if there's anyone, any lobbyists who perhaps... Steve, are you going to testify? You're okay. Do we have any lobbyists that need to testify? Ken? No?
Poor guys.
Okay. I truly want to hear you gentlemen speak, but I have to get upstairs to the speaker. And when you get 10 minutes with the speaker, you take your 10 minutes with the speaker. So I guess I will listen to the tape.
Okay. And the two gentlemen. Please introduce yourself for the record and start your testimony.
I've learned a lot in the last 10 years. I'd like to defer to the chairman of our board first.
Good afternoon. I'm Roy Jay. I'm the chair of the board for the Regional Investment Board for Multnomah, Washington County.
Oh, good. Thank you, Mr. Jay. I'd invite your testimony.
Thank you. I came to support him.
Well, you two flip a coin then.
Okay. We came basically from... miles away to come and support the governor's budget as it pertains to the Regional Investment Board. We're doing wonderful things in the Portland and Washington County areas. We still have a long way to go thing, and it was important for us to take time out of our schedule to come down here and tell you that we're on board. We understand that there's a lot of work to be done. It's still not enough money, but I'm here to ask for some more money as well. So Rob Fussell, who is here from Multnomah County, who is our liaison to the state and for the commissioner is going to give you a little bit more detail. And then I'll just pop in whenever I doggone well feel like it.
Thank you very much. And this is a rather unusual circumstance that we're here at 5 minutes after the hour and there's only one person listening to the testimony. I can assure you that your spoken testimony will become part of the permanent record. Others on the committee will listen to the video, and anything that anyone offers by way of written testimony becomes part of the record and
will
be read.
Well, as long as you understand that I'm just here for the money.
I know that.
Okay.
Send the money and you'll go.
I'm here for the money. Okay.
I think there are others that might be here for the money, too. So please offer your testimony.
Thank you very much, Senator Johnson. My name is Rob Fussell. I'm the Economic Development Manager and Liaison to Business and Industry for Multnomah County Chair Diane Lynn. I'm the Senior Staff for the Multnomah-Washington County Regional Investment Board. I was smart enough to hire Mary MacArthur to assist us with the administration of the program, and she is certainly a godsend. The past 20 years, I have been a prime consumer of the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department support programs, 13 years in private business as the founder of Oregon Business Magazine, 10 years as the Economic Development Manager for the City of Gresham, and more recently, up the last 2.5 years, the City Manager of the City of Gresham, Oregon's fourth largest city. Today, generally, we're interested in making it crystal clear that we support the governor's budget for this program in particular, and we speak in favor of at least maintaining the governor's requested amount. It's particularly intriguing to me that we just happen to have a front-page newspaper article hit on one of the companies that our regional board has funded. It's called Grant Means New Jobs at Multitech. And it's a wire harness manufacturer, happens to be located in Gresham, and it happens to be a company that had a top at 100 employees in the past. It's a 10-year-old company, and it's down to 10 employees, and it identified a new market niche. This program was in the position to help fill that gap. Now we're talking about a big launch. But what happened when this hit the paper was we had our phone started ringing, and it hasn't stopped ringing yet. For prospects who are interested in creating jobs. I'm also intrigued with the with Commissioner Hyde's comments around the idea of the interim work group. This is also our offer to assist and volunteer our time in any effort to that end. The Multnomah-Washington County program has, as you well know, took a while to get off the ground this go-around, but the beauty in it is that it's working. It's divided into two pieces. One piece is in a partnership with the Regional Economic Development Partners to fund grants that, in fact, are job-creating grants in the to create traded sector jobs. And this is one illustration of the kind of success we're having. The other is to create a microenterprise loan program that is, in fact, a lot of talk's been gone around the table here today about, you know, do people have business plans? Is there accountability? How do you count the jobs and what sort of thing? I think it's really intriguing that around our microenterprise lending program, there's a projected 32 loans that will be made to women-owned, minority-owned, small emerging businesses, and a lot of jobs around those 32 loans. So again, we're here on behalf of the support of the governor's budget, and any money you have left over above the budget we'll be able to use. So with that, we thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much, Mr. Jay.
You know, I just want to also say that this couldn't have happened if we hadn't had our relationship with Oregon Community Economic Development. They've been very good to work with, and I understand that we're going through some changes. I'm not the type of person to come down here and spend 8 boring hours sitting in the back, so I just wanted to sort of let you know how come we just can't move this thing along and so we can get back to the business of doing what we do best and trying to create some jobs and do all the things that we have to do. We're sort of sitting at a sort of on the fence right now trying to figure out what's going to be our next move. So these decisions are going to be up to you and everybody else, and I'd like to hopefully that without being real funny and silly about it, just put this stuff on the fast track and let's get on with the business of trying to retain the jobs that we've got out here in Oregon and then create some other ones. And so this is a vital part to our economy in the area that we live in, as well as the rest of the state. So kudos to OEC, CDD. I know that you hear good, bad, and indifferent, but we need to move this thing on. We need to move it on yesterday, and I'll repeat that I am here for the money.
Thank you very much. Okay. Just in response to your question, I think part of what we're doing in this process is to hear from folks that are actually doing it on the ground.
Correct.
And it is very helpful in broadening the legislature's understanding of the successes that are actually happening in the field. I think there's been some misunderstanding about the department's accomplishments, and part of that fault rests with us over two decades of loading the agency up with stuff to do and not really having a good opportunity to hear from the successes. So while this is, I know, annoying for many people who've come today to find us out of time, I appreciate your testimony, and I think it just goes a long ways towards helping the legislature, representing folks from all over the state, understand how the department's doing.
Okay. I believe in this program. I have served. This is going on my seventh year serving on this regional investment board, and I've seen some things happen, and I've seen the success. So thank you for your time. And
Senator Johnson, if I may make one other comment, you know, I've heard stories. You know, well, this program, you know, can't be of any kind of major significance to the metro area. I mean, it's only $700,000 or $800,000 this year. How could that be a big deal? I challenge anyone who says that to count up those checks that are going home from those employees and say that wasn't an important 32 jobs. And so we just like to go on record that we see ourselves as a significant partner with the rest of the state in this program. And that I see us coming together in a new way around the direction the legislature laid down here in the last couple of years. And I think that we have a real sophisticated professional approach backed by and led in a very sophisticated way by the department. And as a team, it makes a significant difference or we wouldn't be sitting here.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. While I still have the gavel before I cede it back over to the chair, I'm going to invite Mr. Chen and Mr. Zapponi to come forward.
Copies of the information you want to take for $9.95.
Good. I like an entrepreneur.
Mr. Chair, with your permission, in addition to the invited testimony of Mr. Zapponi and Mr. Chen, I believe that there are others that might help instruct this panel, Mr. Kramer and Ms. Scruggs. If I could
come on up.
Suggest they come up.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, start?
Yeah, please go ahead. Just introduce yourself for the record.
Chairman and members of the committee, my name is David Chen. I'm a partner at OVP Venture Partners, and I also wear the hat of chairman of ONAMI. And quite bluntly here, I'm here to ask you today to support the bill that's in front of you and the funding and the continued support of for ONAMI. I'd like to keep my...
Walk through that.
Pardon?
Let's walk through that.
Great.
What does $9 million get us?
Thank you. I think $9 million gets you $7 million primarily of infrastructure support for the building out and the continued development of the ONAMI institution.
So is it a building or is it, I thought it was working capital.
It is working capital. It is working capital.
And what is, tell me, $7 million of working capital, what's that going towards?
That will go towards building the various components of the institution, and I'd actually rather is Skip.
I'll have Skip and
Pat actually address that.
$7 million. What are we going to use it for?
Yeah, Chairman Smith, members of the committee. The $7 million will be basically used for four main issues. One will be recruitment packages, which is very similar to the kind of things we use with our strategic reserve fund for recruitment packages for businesses. This is recruitment packages for researchers. With them, there's small amounts of money that leverage them to bring millions of dollars worth of grants and other product with them.
Because of who they are and their credentials.
Yes.
Okay.
The second is on intellectual property development and our tech transfer infrastructure to actually commercialize these. The third is on a small amount of administration for ONAMI, because we actually do need to coordinate not only the three major research institutions, but all universities who are available to play in ONAMI, because it's a open competitive process for nanotechnologies. So we do have administration, and we can get you the other details, and Skip can probably answer that. Okay, Skip.
How much is for administration?
Administration, marketing, a couple other. Skip, do you want to, what's the?
Chair Smith and members of the committee, my name is Skip Rung, Executive Director of ONAMI. It depends on what you count as administration. So the Office of the Executive Director, travel, marketing, and outreach, which is very important for Oregon, will probably be on the order of $400,000. Additional public relations and outreach for business recruitment and things like that could go above that.
Keep expounding on this. Help me here. Help me to help you.
Okay, sure.
$7 million. I want to know how we're going to spend it.
So as Pat has indicated, the investments will be contributions, not full purchase of startup packages for researchers who can bring federal research dollars and reputation to the state of Oregon. There will be assistance in proposals to the federal government. This is mostly about leverage. Leverage to get, as we are doing this biennium, $30 million in grants from the federal government. So we build capacity and enable our researchers to win an increasing share, more market share, of this federal research investment.
Where are they going to be housed?
Where are they going to be housed? They're going to be housed initially at Portland State, Oregon State, and University of Oregon.
How come Eastern wasn't considered?
Eastern is considered, and we have conversations underway with Eastern, OIT, and Southern Oregon University. It is not a closed club.
So, just help me here. So, of that $7 million, if Eastern Oregon University, with their new science building, said, we want to play a role in this, how would you invite them to the table, and how would they know that even though their slice would be very, very small, they get a share, or OIT, or Southern, or Western?
Well, let me give you a real...
Just a quick, I'm sorry, Chairman, members of the committee, just on that. How ONAMI is structured is that it is a partnership of three main institutions, because they have the bulk of the expertise in the nanoscience and microtechnologies. Okay. But the funding distribution is not a formula like research in the higher ed budget. This is going to be a competitive process like all other grants that we do through this agency. So if Eastern or OIT or Southern Oregon have people within the nano and micro technologies areas that would like to work either by themselves or with other researchers in other institutions, they can pull together a grant, submit it to ONAMI, which is a partnership which includes a lot of industry people and university people together on this board, and then those projects will be funded based on their competitive nature. Okay, and so that's how Eastern, that's how Southern, that's how OIT will be playing in all of this. And so,
do they know that?
I believe that they do.
Help us help you. Can you get word out to them on that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we will be happy to
maybe clarify it for them.
And you've got to also understand that ONAMI as an entity has only been officially established for about 45 days.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
So bear with us, please.
Chairman Smith, if I can maybe up-level this, I think if ONAMI was created to do, I think, several agendas, and one of the first and foremost agendas was to create a collaborative, shared environment among our research universities. I think if you've been around the university environment, I think you know exactly how siloed it is. In the culture of academia, it's about my research. And so one of the things that we've actually, I think, innovated on in this state with ONAMI is to create this collaborative environment. The reason I think that that's an important underpinning is that the name of the game here is about getting research dollars for funded programs, and the funded programs come from either the federal government's agenda, research institutions' agendas, and or private enterprises' agendas. Now, what we've tried to do then is basically those are the quote-unquote customers. That's actually the research dollars, whether it's NIH, Department of Defense, Department of Energy, PNNL itself,
those are all the funding sources, or whether it's a private enterprise, Intel asking for a contract of research, or FEI asking for a contract of research. Within that context, I think one of the most innovative things that has started to happen with Onami is that researchers out of either U of O, PSU initially, and OSU, and it certainly will expand to OIT and Eastern Oregon, is as they grab a hold of a proposal or an area of research that they believe has a market, a proposal source, a grant source, that they're openly inviting now collaboration across across both institutions within the state and outside of the state. I mean, that's a fundamental departure from the way things are done.
So what if you had more than $9 million? What could you do? I never thought you'd hear that question, did you?
I could, you know, I believe that, I mean, there's a budget constraints here, and what we need to do is, we have a $9 million budget right now. We think we can leverage quite a bit. We can leverage over $100 million with that $9 million of federal. You know, we can leverage 30 to 60.
If this policy committee decided, this budget committee tried to set policy through the budget and allocated more money, what could you do with it?
I would recommend you work with the governor's office and come up with those. I did.
There's no opportunity for additional leverage beyond?
Oh, yes.
I'll paint out two extremes here. Simply put, the more money you put into this, the more programs of research in the nanotechnology, microtechnology spaces that I think you can foster. The more chances we will have to attract the world leaders in research to this area. That being said, I also think that being a venture capitalist, there's also an old adage, which is that you can actually love a company to death.
Sure.
You can actually put too much money into it. And so I think the complete opposite extreme is, for example, state of California stem cell research, where we're talking literally billions of dollars of state funding. I wouldn't be an advocate of that either. I think that actually what we're doing here in this state is very wise, which is to put in the order of 9 or 10 or $20 million, but a manageable enough that shows critical mass, but at the same time forces us to think out of the box and get and incorporate, I think, one of the most important assets that we have in this state in nanotechnology competition, and that's private enterprise.
Perfect. Thank you. Welcome.
Hello. My name is David Zappone. I'm the president of the Northwest Food Processors, and I appreciate the opportunity, Chair Smith and committee members, to address this subcommittee. I'm here because I'm representing food processing industry. We're one of those private sector folks that hopes to benefit from the innovation economy that so many people are testifying in favor of. Food processors are a backbone of this state and this region. We have been a backbone for nearly 100 years now. And I think it's time that we start looking at the industry as such. We represent 88 food processors, over 450 companies in the Northwest. Those include the supplier members and other agencies and quasi-government agencies. We're the third largest manufacturing sector. We have 17,000 family wage jobs in Oregon, 500,000 in payroll. We have in your packets that I think you should have received, there's a benchmarking study, because we are tracking to see how we're doing and trending that data to make sure that we are achieving our goals. And I'm here to support innovation in the state. And I want to make a special note to with you on the industry sector outreach program, which has helped us to move forward. We asked for $25,000, and we got that, and that was a big advantage. So we want to thank you for that particular program. It helped us to do what we call the Food Processors Association's Economic Cluster Initiative. The Cluster Initiative is a roadmap for economic vitality or revitalization of the food processing industry, which has, as you know, gone through a number of challenges over the last few years, including consolidations, eroding strategic advantages, customer concentration, and globalization. And the industry, to its credit, has decided to work together as one group. We've redefined our competitors not to be the guy down the street, but to be the companies that are in Chile and China and other regions of the United States that are really pounding down on our door. Now, I want to emphasize that we are resource-based, And so that means we are going to be here, unless you're planning on moving the land to China or to Chile. I think we're going to be here for a long time. And I believe that an investment in innovation is the key to our future. We're a knowledge economy. We're an innovation-driven economy, and we need to get there. Cluster modeling starts with innovation, which drives productivity. That improves our competitiveness, which leads to financial success. That's a simple model. But innovation is the starting point. We need to invest in that. We need to make sure that our colleges and institutions of higher learning are supported adequately. We also need to provide for incumbent training. And so that, therefore, our innovation is critical to the future of our members. Working within the industry, we have to reframe our competitors, make sure that we find solutions in our neighbors, not only in this state, but also in the three Northwest states. The cluster project, I was told many years ago, 3 years ago when we started it, that we'd never get the three states to work collaboratively for an economic development program. So we have to assess projects, adapt, and adopt new technologies. I'm going to give you some examples of things that we've done in terms of clusters and working together in innovation. First of all, we start with people. People are very important to us, and we want to have family wage jobs. And for the most part, the industry does provide family wage jobs. We want to train our incumbent workers, making sure that they have adequate training so that they can learn about the new technologies that are coming to the plant. So things like training programs like lean manufacturing are critically important to us. We want to make sure that we have technically trained, science-based students coming out of our institutions of higher learning to make sure that they are in the plants, making sure that all these wonderful things that are being developed through the incubators and through these primary processes of innovation are brought to practice and bear in our plants. For example, in the Port of Morro, as you know, we have a little cluster there of food processors. Getting plants, those plants, the best and the most productive technology is critically important to us. So we want to make sure that that happens. We have, a few years back, we developed in the area of workforce development, we shared knowledge through a career ladder and skills program. That was an exceptional brochure that we put out. Lately, we have developed, just recently, through the Northwest Energy Efficiency Alliance, and we've distributed it, a refrigeration best practices guide. That's a follow-up to the skills ladder for refrigeration. And recently, there's been a couple of programs that we've been working on for energy, and I believe the UNAMI is going to be looking at energy as well. But energy is going to be a huge problem for us this summer with the drought. We need to figure out ways to be more energy efficient. And there's a couple of projects that I mentioned here. One is Oregon Freeze Dry. They've done an energy efficiency study, as well as West Farm Foods. West Farm is a creamery in Portland in the urban setting, so we have both urban and rural members, and that has significantly increased or reduced their use of energy. Three final points. One is that we support innovation, and we believe that's the next step for the future of the food processing industry, a traditional industry. Number two, industry sector outreach fund. The industry sector outreach fund was absolutely essential. They were the first ones out of the box that came in with our $279,000 cluster road mapping project. They gave us the money that we could start the match with the other states. Subsequent to that initial investment, all three states in the Northwest, including private contributions, has made the match the federal government requires. We should, in the next couple days, determine whether or learn whether the Economic Development Administration is going to fund the project, their half of the project, and all indications are that they will. And finally, food processing is really not a real flashy industry. We're not the high flyers. You don't see us. The investment bankers don't talk about us a lot. But the fact is that we are an important economic engine in this Northwest territory, and we need to make sure that we support it and we recognize that and we use it as the bedrock or the foundation from which to launch our emerging industries. Thank you.
Thank you. That was terrific testimony. Senator
Dunn. Mr. Zapponi, I wanted to ask you, particularly when I saw Mr. Chen's head nodding yes about about working, UNAMI working in energy. How helpful has the Energy Trust been in providing money, and how helpful could they be?
I believe the Energy Trust has been a great help. It's allowed us to reach to fund a tipping point for many of our projects, and I believe a couple of the projects that I mentioned here, Oregon Freeze Dried was funded in part. I believe it was Oregon Freeze Dried was funded in part by the Oregon Energy Trust.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, please.
Respectfully, I have now appointments stacking up in my office. I need to abandon you.
Who else do we have needing to testify? From why don't we do that? I appreciate that we've gone long over. Come on up. We'll do this really quick, and we'll pass this on to those who need to hear it.
Griffey Smith, my name is Don Kramer. I'm an attorney with Schwab, Williamson, Wyatt. I have been involved in Oregon's entrepreneurial community for the past 20 years. I was down here as a legislative aide in the early 80s when the economy was not doing too well, and I've watched sort of this sort of come to fruit. I have a 4 o'clock with you in your office, but I'm going to talk to you here directly today. The $9 million that you are talking about making an investment in NAMI and innovation is probably one of the key investments that you're going to make in this committee, this legislative session. I know you spent the last 5 days talking about where you go, but what we're talking about is the future of where the Oregon economy is going to be, where the jobs are going to be. It has been identified by the Oregon Business Plan 3 years ago that building innovation capacity is one of the key areas of Oregon's economic future.
Let me interrupt you there really quick. How do you avoid winners and losers?
Well, I think we came to terms with that probably about 2 or 3 years ago when we created NAMI. The thing I learned with NAMI, and Dave Chin, who was sitting up here just a few minutes ago, taught me this, you need to have private sector players, significant private sector players at the table. For years now, I've sort of come down here, and we need to support what we're doing in small business. We need to support what we're doing in emerging business, and then you've got larger business. Part of the problem is the state. We've never really harnessed what big business is doing in terms of innovation. Oregon is one of the biggest producers of patents nationally per capita. And the reason is Intel's located up in the Portland area. ESI is up there, Tektronix, IBM. One of the things that NAMI's tried to do is bring these private sector players to the table and basically connect them into our higher ed system in a way to commercialize activities. I spent almost my entire 6 months of 2001 down here sort of pushing for a bunch of bills around the new economy. And, you know, we were just starting to figure out what all that meant. There was a ballot measure the voters approved by 80% to allow universities to commercialize research. I think what NAMI is, and you know, you've had from Tom Butler to Ryan Deckard up here, this has been vetted by a group called the Oregon right. Council on Knowledge and Economic Development. And Senator or Representative Smith, I know you well. I would just ask you to ponder, you know, a lot of what Don Kramer talks about is trying to do the right thing. I think this is one of those do the right thing. $9 million in your budget is not a whole lot of money, but in terms of the ultimate leverage it can do, in terms of the one thing that nobody has even raised today, you've got both Gordon Smith and Ron Wyden basically pushing this agenda back in D.C. very, very vigorously. I'm going to go back with 35 CEOs from the Portland area on a trip next week, and we've identified 3 winners. One is this nanotechnology. The second is open source. We have Linus at up in the Portland area, and then we also have healthcare IT, which there's a bunch of stuff going on there. So we have identified, you know, this is, we're not throwing money all over. Right. It's a very focused kind of effort. So my plea here today, and I debated whether I should come down here and whether my voice is important, but I speak from my heart today is don't make this a political issue. This is an issue about doing the right thing, and I'm available by phone or whatnot if you want to talk afterwards, but I just want to go on the record that this is something very important for the state of Oregon. I hope you consider it.
Well, I appreciate that. My opening comments were I think we have a very good department where we need to sharpen up a few areas, and it sounds like a lot of people with much smarter ideas than I are supporting innovation. I've been skeptical of it for one reason, and it's a definition. I think the department needs to do a better job explaining what innovation is, because just like economic development, everyone has a different idea.
Representative Smith, let me help you there. I'm currently working on another project. The Greater Portland region is putting together a regional business plan, and we're trying to get around that. So I've gathered a lot of that, and I'm more than happy to share. But the Small Business Administration, just within the last 2 weeks, has released a study that very specifically defines that. And it basically says innovation by itself fails, but if you connect it to sort of entrepreneurship and put those two concepts together, and there's a lot of research out there. And I guess what I'm sort of suggesting to you, if you want to get together privately or have a discussion about that, I spent a lot of time sort of watching this grow, and, you know, there's a lot of people that still don't know, but there is a lot of good data out there, and I do think it has been vetted internally in the state, and I, you know, I'm asking you to trust me on that. But
well, and I'd share with you, finishing up what I was going to say, I think Pat has done a very good job earning her keep on this issue. She has truly had to fight through 90 different members. I think Marty Brantley has done a very, very good job on this. Obviously, this is important to a large segment of the economy, and obviously our committee needs to seriously, seriously take that under consideration. And so your message has come through very loud and clear. Again, I'm just a simple person from Eastern Oregon, and I know when people get confused, they speculate, and when they speculate to the negative. And I think the department would do itself a tremendous favor by taking what could be perceived as an elite communication and bringing it down just a little bit so folks can understand it.
I appreciate you allowing me to speak.
Tremendous. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Welcome.
Oh, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. My name is Peter Guerin. I'm the Executive Director of the Port of Astoria. The Port of Astoria is a small regional port authority at the mouth of the Columbia River with an annual operating budget of a mere $2.7 million. 6 years ago, following the demise of its log export operations, the port was floundering. A new commission armed with a new strategic plan and quantitative goals set out to reverse that position. The Oregon Economic Community Development Department has played a key role in reaching those goals by providing $15.5 million in loan and grant funding for airport and waterfront projects over the last 4 years. Job impact, 147 jobs. The investment in port infrastructure has spurred private investment as well. When the breakwater protecting the West Mooring Basin failed, the department provided $4.6 million to restore that breakwater and provide additional floats for the fishing fleets. With the ability to service the fishing fleets, fish processors located their facilities adjacent to the marina, investing approximately $7.6 million and creating approximately 200 jobs. The port opened a new boatyard adjacent to the fish processors. Spurred by the growth of these fishing-related activities, England Marine begins construction next month of its new $4 million marine supply store at the base of the boatyard. This success would not have been possible without the assistance of the department. They have been helpful in crafting financing strategies tailored to meet the unique requirements of the port, and they didn't waste time doing it. In the last two projects, the $6.8 million Bornstein Seafood project and the $3.3 million Electro project, the department was able to process and approve these applications within 30 days of submittal. There aren't many banks in the private sector that can meet that level of efficiency. Providing loans and grants is not the only service provided to ports by the department. They provide an advocacy role at both the state and federal level, including providing lobbying firm support. This support has been a benefit to the port in helping to secure over $18 million in federal funding for reconstruction of the port's East Mooring Basin breakwater, which provides additional moorage for the area fishing fleets. Continued department support for the activities of the port remains crucial. The private sector has invested an additional $8.3 million in Port Marina District with the expectation the Astoria Conference Center will be constructed. Funding for this $5.5 million project is being sought from the department. The Port of Astoria urges the Ways and Means Committee to recognize this excellent work and effectiveness of the department as evidenced above in its deliberations. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I think the department does do an excellent job. Do you want the Ports Division back?
We'd like to see it. I think the Ports Division within Oregon Economic Development, yes.
So you do want it back?
Yeah.
Thank you. Welcome.
Hi.
I'm Diane Vines. I'm president of the Oregon Science and Technology Partnership, and I was formerly vice chancellor for the Oregon University System, and it's in that regard that I'm here to say something about the SB 838. I just want to say that this is an unprecedented cooperation between and among the four research, the big research universities and smaller research universities, Pacific Northwest National Lab. I mean, when you have the ducks and the beavers and the Vikings and the doctors and the PNNL researchers working together, this is a very impressive possibility. We bring in, with those institutions, about $1.2 billion into the region in research money, funding. And innovation in my book is getting that innovation, that kind of research results, out into the commercial world. If you talk about, when we talk about innovation, we talk about the generation of new technologies and ideas and then the utilization of those new technologies and ideas. So it includes companies in all sectors, in sectors in Oregon. So I would just like to congratulate you for the original amount of money and investment in ONAMI and in the research commercialization, and urge you to continue that, and on behalf of also the research universities.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think that's excellent. Yeah. Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Mike Gull. I'm the Deputy Executive Director at the Oregon International Port of Coos Bay. I want to thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today. I would like to provide testimony today in regards to the Port of Coos Bay's positive working relationship with the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department. Specifically, I would like to comment on our partnerships with the department on recent projects and what that partnership has meant for infrastructure improvements and jobs within the Port District and throughout Oregon's Bay Area. Now, I'm going to comment on just five projects, but certainly that's not the only projects we're working on with the department. Project 800 Support. This project involved the construction of an 18,000-square-foot building for an incoming call center, created 620 jobs. Project Charleston Boatyard Site Improvements. This project, working with the Department of Environmental Quality, was a volunteer site cleanup program providing cleanup, paving, and new stormwater collection technology infrastructure that allowed the Charleston Boatyard, the only full-service boatyard in Oregon's south coast, to remain open. This project retained four businesses, retained 26 jobs, and provides direct support for over 500 commercial fishing jobs in Coos County. Project Coos Bay Rail Bridge Rehabilitation. This project provided matching funds for federal dollars that allowed the rail bridge Phase 1 rehabilitation, extending the operating life of the rail bridge and maintaining the viability of the short line operator. Without this project, it retained 405 jobs. If we could not keep the rail bridge operating, two major sawmills south of the bridge would have shut down immediately. Project North Spit Rail Spur. This project provides critical missing infrastructure on Coos Bay's North Spit, opens up an additional 350-plus acres of public and privately owned industrial land to rail service, and increases the viability of the main line from Eugene, Oregon to Coos Bay. The immediate benefactor of this project was South Coast Forest Products. That's a local sawmill that needed to be on rail. They chose to build a new mill in Coos Bay and keep their jobs there versus leaving the area. This job created 20 new jobs, retained 65 jobs, and provided $15 million in private investment for infrastructure on Coos Bay's North Spit. Project TK. This project is confidential in nature, but I can tell you Coos Bay has made the short list of four sites out of the 160 sites worldwide initially considered. If we're successful, this project will create 100 new jobs and provide $200 million of private infrastructure investment on Coos Bay's North Spit. Port of Coos Bay also participates in the Port's Buying and Marketing Grant Program, and the department's contract lobbyist at the federal level has been instrumental in securing federal funding for the Rail Bridge Phase 1 project, $5.5 million in federal funding, and for the Rail Bridge Phase 2 project, now in the transportation bill, an additional $8 million. The project I have commented on today, excluding Project TK, has resulted in a total of 640 jobs created 503 jobs retained, over $15 million in private investment, not to mention the temporary jobs during the construction period. And I think the message that I want to send to this committee today and to the state is none of this would have been accomplished without the department's funding programs and the partnership provided by the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department. I want to thank you for the opportunity to appear before you.
Well, we appreciate you coming here. I know Senator Berger wanted to remain, but she had another committee that she's chairing. Quick question. Would you like a ports division?
Representative, I think if you would ask that question to every port, all 23 ports in the state of Oregon, everyone would answer the same way I'm going to answer, and that's a strong yes.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Anyone else want to testify? We truly appreciate you sticking with us 46 minutes after the end of the committee hearing. Cora, thank you very much. Seeing no objection, we're going to adjourn for the day. Great job, Department. Great job.